Throughout today's Boston Public Radio, we'll get reports from the marathon racer. Then it's Ground Truth Project's Charlie Sennett. We'll touch on the sinking of that migrant ship and ISIS expanding. Then it's politics with Mike Astrew and John Nucci as the 19 Republican men and one Democratic woman who would be president travel to New Hampshire. And then we'll ask, should New Hampshire have the nation's first primary to begin with? Then he won the marathon in 1968 and is the oldest champion running today. Amby Burfoot joins us.
So we're going to ask you if all those skinny marathon runners bouncing down Boylston Street inspired you next year, or you just say, hey, that's great, but forget about it. It's also Patriots Day, though, and we're going to give every marathon caller a chance to answer a question from our brilliant Patriots Day quiz. Then the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price on Apple's racially diverse emoji, TV guru Bob Thompson on a scandal involving the great late Lucille Ball and swearing on TV. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello. Happy Marathon Day, Jim.
And happy to you. And by the way, I brought records of my two official finishes in the New York City Marathon, which I'll present to you at noon, Marjorie.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Well, no, the deal was you bring yours,
I will bring mine.
Well,
from the Marine Corps Marathon. I think that explains everything.
In any case, joining us in line from where the marathon began is WGBH's Edgar B. Herrick III. He's been in Hopkinton since, I don't know, since a week ago or something, but he is there now. Hey, Edgar.
Hey, how's it going? Have you guys ever seen sunrise in Hopkinton? I haven't until today.
No, but it must have been freezing out there for sunrise in Hopkinton. You feel bad for these runners.
Yeah, I know. You know what, though? I'll tell you what, though, Marjorie. To be honest with you, it was actually warmer at about 6 a.m. than it is now. It's kind of steadily gotten colder through the morning. I think it's probably in large part because the sort of moister air has moved in. It's now raining for the second time today. We had a little bit of rain before the race actually started. And as I'm looking at the starting line right now, wave four is about to go off. And it's a pretty, it's what you would call a light rain, somewhere between a drizzle and a light rain right now.
So, Edgar, what's the porta potty situation out there? In past years, we've had disputes and some complaints from some of the residents there about runners not using the correct procedures. Everything copacetic in that front?
Actually, it's pretty impressive. It's actually funny that you bring that up, Marjorie, because I took a picture of a line of porta potties at one point, and I was like, "Can I see this or not?" I couldn't quite figure it out because I was impressed. I was like, "There's one thing that they definitely have enough of here, and it's porta potties."
That's
so
great.
The porta potty situation is totally copacetic.
Yeah, you said wave four is about to go off. What does that mean? Is wave one are the fastest, most elite runners, and then wave two and four are the And not that anybody's slow because there's a qualifying time, but is that the deal?
No, I'm not sure if those waves are by time or not, but all of the waves are separate from the elite. So what happens here is the very first people to go off are the people in wheelchairs, the people in the hand cycles, and all of that, and then the elite women went off at 9:30, and the elite men went off at shortly thereafter at 10. Now, those elite groups are actually really small. There's only about, 20 runners or something in those elite groups. Then immediately after the elite men go off, wave one goes off. That's 7,500 people. And then wave two, 7,500 more. Wave three, 7,500 more. Wave four, 7,500 more. So those are what I'm talking about when I say wave. So, I mean, the vast majority of these people are obviously not competing for the actual crown, the actual great time, personal bests and just finishing for a lot of these folks, but that's the wave.
By the way, the wheelchair winners are already in. Marcel E. Hug, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm sure I'm not. It's from Switzerland. He won in 1:29.53. On the women's side, Tatiana McFadden from the USA, 1:32.45.
But I should point out, actually, that you don't have to be fast because you can be a charity.
Oh, the charity thing,
the
yeah.
charity thing. So you can be you could be like a six-hour marathoner and be coming in way late this afternoon. You got to raise a lot
raise
of money.
I think it's $7,000 or something.
A friend of mine's running for Brigham and Women's, $7,500. Mm. But he managed to raise $10,000. So people are really generous to marathon contributions.
Hey, Edgar, before you go away, when 35,000 people running, give or take a few, it's like a city, right? Early in the morning, it must be totally great out there.
Wait, say that again one more time, Jim.
35. I mean, when everybody is assembled before the first group goes off, there are 35,000 people there. That's like a major American city, at least for Massachusetts, kind of city.
It is, but, you know, it's interesting logistically how they do it. So they have what they call their athlete village, which is about a half mile up the road. And so all of the runners go through that athlete village area, and then they get shipped up to the actual starting line in those waves. So you don't see all 35,000 people who are running the race at one time at the start line. But I'll tell you what, just the 7,500 people in each wave is really, really impressive. They set the gun off, and the wave of runners go, and for about two straight minutes, people are starting, you know? So you really get a sense of how many people 7,500 is. But like I said, you don't see all of them at the same time, and yet it's still impressive when you see those 7,500 at a time taking off.
Okay, Edgar, do us a favor. Can you stay in Hopkinton till tomorrow? We'll call you tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock.
That sounds great, Jim. That sounds really good. Why don't you come to meet me in Hopkinton tomorrow morning? We'll get coffee and watch the sunrise.
Okay.
Edgar B. Herwick III from the starting line in Hopkinton. Thanks, Edgar.
Very much, Edgar.
So in any case, the marathon is not just a local event. You all know this, but a global sport. Participants from all over the world, more than 100 nations, from the Czech Republic to the Dominican Republic, are expected to run. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about the global reach of the marathon and much more is Charlie Sennett. Charlie is a news analyst here at GBH. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hey there, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
You know, we have been talking endlessly about the Olympics here and how the global impact of and the impact on Boston having the Olympics. But in a smaller way, this is a big deal
as
well.
It's a really big deal, and it's an historic deal. I think we who are of New England, we think of the marathon as just part of the spring season. You know, we think of it as that first time when you can really go out in shorts and sit on the side of the road, although that's not a good idea today because it's like a raw, cold, rainy day. But really, I don't know, the history of it is something that is just a great pride of Boston. I think everybody knows this history because they're all watching it, but it is going back to 1897, following the 1896 Olympic event, the first marathon for the Olympics. And I really love this fact that it's one of the only events, national events, that carried through both world wars and never stopped during those wars. So this is something that, you know, even when we're challenged, as we were with the horrific bombing 2 years ago, and we think about Boston Strong, it's been Boston Strong for a really long time. And I love that. I love that through World War I, through World War II, they kept running. And there's only four events in the United States of America, these sort of big celebrated public events, that continued through the World Wars. So I'll give you two, and I want to see if you can guess the third. Well, there's the marathon, one. There's the Kentucky Derby. There's the Rose Parade. There's one more that shocked me.
I have no idea. Would it be
it's
the
world? It's not a sporting event as far as I'm concerned.
No
the Roller Derby Championship?
No, close. Westminster Kennel Club
dog.
That's
my favorite. God. Well, the dogs must not be denied. Absolutely not.
Dog strong.
You know, so that means the World Series by process of elimination. That must have continued during the...
Well, I think there were times
continued.
During the war where it did
postponed.
Not continue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So
you ever run a marathon?
I have not. No.
Well, you know, actually,
PMC is as close as I get. That's
it's funny
on a
you should
bicycle.
Say that. I ran two, and I have the results here. Marjorie does not have hers.
Do?
So does that suggest to you that maybe she didn't run a marathon?
Yeah, he is.
I have my
I'll have
two
to get
results
my,
right
I'll have
here,
to get
Marjorie.
My witnesses.
I'm holding them up.
I got a number when I was young for Boston.
Uh-huh.
I had an alcoholic boyfriend, actually, who used to run off his hangovers. So I started running with him. I wonder if he's listening right now. He doesn't live far away. And so after 10 or 12, it would take him a lot of miles to run off those hangovers. So I got to be a long-distance runner. But I was claiming that I ran faster than Jim, and he says that's not true.
It happens not to be true.
I think
in
you can look at the two of us. Look at the two of us.
That was a while ago.
You're running this year, I think. Aren't you?
No,
right out of here. You're going to crack out of here down there, right?
In any case, from a relatively joyous celebration to a really sad one, John Dawson, Corporal John Dawson, is being buried today in Upton, Massachusetts, the first soldier, and soldier to be killed in Afghanistan, American soldier, in 2015. I don't even know how to put this. Is only one death like this? He was doing an escort kind of thing. Does that show it's a safer place and that's perverse good news? What's the significance here, other than the fact that a young
question.
Man,
I mean,
22 years old, has lost his life in Jalalabad?
Yeah, I mean, and if you think about it, the fact that the funeral at St. Gabriel's in Upton, Massachusetts, is just a few miles from the start of
that's
the
a
marathon.
That's a great point.
Yes.
It means potentially, I guess, a traffic jam, but it also means something that these two events, that they really do cross roads. I mean, it is Patriots Day. And the idea of the sacrifice that the soldiers are making who are still serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, some of these guys are on their fourth, fifth, even sixth tours. This is never done in the history of the United States that we've had a war go on this long. 14 years of war in Afghanistan, the longest war in America's history. And as you know, as of January 1, the combat mission ended. So now those forces are pulled back to the bases. And the idea is that they are now there to assist and support as the Afghan National Army pushes forward and takes the lead role. That's why we're seeing fewer American casualties. This casualty that happened with Corporal John Dawson, who was a combat medic, who sounds like an amazing guy, 22 years old. Everything you hear from his family was about his dedication to public service. That I heard his relatives say he was not a cowboy. He was not a warrior. He wanted to be there as a medic. He wanted to serve his country as a medic, which is kind of a unique distinction, I think. He was part of this convoy, and it was what they call now an insider attack, meaning an Afghan in an army uniform is apparently the one who killed him in this literally like a drive-by shooting on this convoy.
That's far from the first of that sort, correct?
We have had a spate of these, and this is a really serious issue that the Taliban have infiltrated the Afghan National Army on many levels, even if it's just stealing uniforms. Because you remember, we were there that week of April 8th when Dawson was killed. He was killed far from where we were. He was killed in Jalalabad. But that week was the start of what is often referred to in Afghanistan as the fighting season, this sort of ritual that every springtime, as the mountains go from the snows to the green sort of hillsides, it's absolutely beautiful and lethal. It's when the Taliban really comes out, or through history when fighters have come out. So we saw these attacks in Mazar-e-Sharif, where we also saw men dressed in Taliban uniforms attack the courthouses, which, remember, we talked about this. This is where the 10 people were killed, 50 mm-hmm. wounded, in the relatively quiet corner of Mazar. Here you have the, quote, insider attack with another person in a Afghan National Army uniform. So you have really scary situation in which the Afghan National Army, ANA, appears to be both infiltrated, and the Taliban seem to have these uniforms, and they're using them to great effect.
Well, you know, beyond the Taliban in Afghanistan, which we've talked to you about quite a bit, there are reports that this bombing in eastern Afghanistan, the Islamic State is claiming responsibility for, killed at least 34 people, injured 125. And the significance of that, assuming that it's true, it's the first time the Islamic State apparently has created such havoc and perpetrated such violence this far from their traditional operating grounds in the Middle East, North Africa, etc. That tied to the fact that they are apparently on the advance in places like Ramadi in Iraq. This is so much for ISIS being a crushed threat, correct?
I'm not sure yet. I think this is what I would call test marketing in Afghanistan. I think that ISIS is a brand and a black flag and an idea and a death cult. That doesn't mean it's a functioning enterprise with a lot of coordination. You know, it was General John Campbell, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, who first really alerted this country about the threat of ISIS in Afghanistan. He did this when he came back and testified to Congress. Look, it's a real issue. It's something to pay close attention to. But I think we have to be careful in making it too broad a sweep in how we look at this. This is a Washington Post article today, had probably the best coverage on it, but it was really confusing. It was basically saying that this is the Pakistani Taliban claiming to be ISIS. And then you have other elements of the Pakistani Taliban denying that it sponsored this attack. And then you have the Afghan Taliban also denying that it sponsored this attack.
So it may not be ISIS.
So it may be a breakaway faction that wants to scare the hell out of people by putting up the black flag and calling itself ISIS. And that's what I mean by this sort of perverse, very dark brand marketing strategy that I think is going on in Afghanistan right now. Keep an eye on it, but I don't think we should overestimate it. Or I don't think we should exaggerate what it really could be right now.
But meanwhile, you've got back in Iraq, you've got the reports also in the Washington Post about these thousands of families, 20,000 of them stranded at a checkpoint trying to flee Ramadi because they're worried about ISIS. You know, Charlie, just a couple of weeks ago, I thought I read where things were looking better in terms of getting rid of ISIS because the airstrikes, which obviously hasn't stopped them, at least had bombed enough of the oil fields that their source of income was on the wane, and that might be the beginning of the end. But this doesn't look like the beginning of the end at all.
No, I think, look, ISIS is a very determined foe, and they are actively engaged. And they're actively engaged in Iraq in horrific ways. Ramadi, if you remember the battle that the U.S. fought in Ramadi to take back Ramadi from the Sunni militants, to see that wave returning is incredible. And they're talking about this being more fierce fighting even than when the U.S. was protecting Ramadi. And I was there. I remember that fighting. It was fierce. It involved a lot of units from Massachusetts. So a lot of the Massachusetts veterans who were killed in Iraq died in Ramadi. There was one unit out of Fort Devens in particular that was in Ramadi. And I believe I have that right. I remember I met these guys at Devens, at least. I'm pretty sure they were based out of there. This is a real intense effort by ISIS to step up its attacks in Iraq. We can't not pay attention to it. These unbelievable videos they've released of the Islamic State,
yes,
you know, where you have more horrific imagery. Now, they're talking about a mass grave with 1,700 Shiite soldiers who were apparently killed by ISIS that are being uncovered now.
This is
really
horrible.
Getting to be the level of it's a war crime to begin with, but I think it's really getting to the level of a global need to come together to recognize the war crimes that are being committed by ISIS. Did you see these new video images as well of the executed Christians from Ethiopia?
Yes.
Adding to the Egyptian Christians who were killed, you now have these Ethiopians being marched on a beach and executed.
Again,
and
in the orange jumpsuits.
In the orange jumpsuits. And this is a death cult. We keep talking about it, but we have to pay attention to it. And I would just quickly add, In Afghanistan and in Iraq, ISIS is a threat. But we sometimes in the media, we're focusing too much. It's almost like a hyper-focus on that darkness. And we forget that people like Dawson, Corporal Dawson, are over there fighting every day in Afghanistan. And we're forgetting about that war in Afghanistan. And I want to invite listeners to say, we have this project coming, Forever
yeah.
Stan. Afghanistan and the Road to Ending America's Longest War. We're doing this in partnership with WGBH Digital, WGBH News, and we're really trying to dig in to this longest war in our history and say we have to pay attention. So we've talked about this before, but we're circling what's called the Ring Road in Afghanistan, 1,300 miles of highway at the center of the country that connects the major cities. And this project, I hope, will remind people of the intensity of the moment as the U.S. prepares to draw down its forces over the next year. We'll probably start it in 2016. We are in a really tough spot. It's 14 years of war, and we have to pay attention to this exit strategy and to this end game. So Forever Stan, you can find it on WGBHnews.org. Or you can also find it on our site, thegroundtruthproject.org.
You know, when you said people aren't paying attention, and I think I applaud you and then some for the work you've been doing, the American people are not paying attention. And in part, it's because our leaders aren't paying attention. The only time you hear anything, again, America's longest war, I'm sure I may have missed something, but other than when there's an appropriation decision to be made, they don't even debate this thing.
I think
they're young men and women, obviously, in the case of Dawson, dying, but at minimum, fighting. And the people who are elected representatives.
Well, the Republicans were talking about it up in New Hampshire. It's certainly becoming
No, but just as a
campaign.
Cudgel to use against Hillary Clinton, by the way, and which may be appropriate, may not be, but that's an election cycle ploy. The men and women we elect, the 535 men and women we elect, have committed troops around the world, including, as you say repeatedly, the longest war and not a peep. It's really scandalous. And my attitude is, if you don't care enough to debate it, then bring the men and women home so there are no more John Dawsons. You know, the reason I felt so weird saying what I said before, it's only one death. That is one death.
Jim,
more than.
But at the same time, you talk about bringing everybody home from Afghanistan, you're faced with this takeover of Iraq after we left. So I think the pressure is going to be huge.
So should we add more troops?
I am becoming an isolationist in my old age, but I think that the political pressure that we're going to let happen to Afghanistan what happened to ISIS.
The president has said he intends to remove all troops by the end of 2016.
But one of the big criticisms he's taking from Republicans, rightly or wrongly, is that he abandoned Iraq too soon. And just one thing, I know we don't want to focus intently on ISIS here, but I read this piece yesterday that I don't know if you saw, the Times Magazine piece about all the Britons joining ISIS. And it blew away a lot of our stereotypes. They're not necessarily poor. They're not necessarily disenfranchised. That the level of prejudice against Muslims in Great Britain is nowhere near what it is in France, the Charlie Hebdo thing we all know about. That there are people that have risen in politics, risen in business, that there's more of an assimilation of Muslims. So it's kind of like... Well, it is really frightening that these young men are going by the hundreds.
I agree, and I can't think of a more important day to ask all these hard questions about what is the future of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and Iraq than Patriots Day. This is a day where you want to put these questions forward because we love to celebrate the marathon. We love these traditions in Boston, but we have a lot of people who are still serving this country over there who are putting themselves in harm's way. We're going to have a discussion here at GBH tomorrow night. Both Jim and Marjorie
are
looking forward to having
you.
So it's here. It's at 6 p.m. at WGBH.
Is it open to the public?
It's open to the public for listeners of this show. It is open to the public.
Oh,
we're not
okay.
announcing this everywhere. But no, really, we've had a discussion here for months about all of these issues. We have a chance to talk about the future of international news, really look at how the next generation will tell the story. So we have NPR's Deb Amos, the reporter on the
Terrific.
Front lines in Iraq and Syria. We have a guy named Joel Simon, who's the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, who's really insightful, written a new book about the perils journalists face, not just physical perils, but also the cyber perils they face. And I'm really honored to say we'll have John and Diane Foley here as well.
Oh, great.
And they're going to be part of this event and really trying to celebrate the work of our young reporters who we are increasingly encouraging to cover issues like climate change, immigration, issues outside of conflict reporting, because there's so much talent among young reporters. Too much of it is flocking to war reporting. What we need to do is expand the definition of the future of news. So join us tomorrow, 6 p.m. here at GBH. The Ground Truth launches in partnership with GBH.
One last thing before you go, one last piece of horrific news.
The world is in such a mess now.
These hundreds of migrants are presumed to be dead on this ship that capsized off the Libyan coast. Headed for Europe, and now they're squabbling back and forth. Has Europe been doing enough in terms of rescue missions, not just for this, apparently, because there have been hundreds of others lost? What's going on here?
Huge issue. This is an issue that is, I don't think it's historically inaccurate to compare this to the levels of human trafficking we had even at the time of the slave trade, in terms of deaths at sea and the terms of the risk people are willing to take to come to this country. We are hearing European voices comparing it to the slave trade. I think this is an enormous issue. This is one that is not on the radar. It's the kind of reporting we want to do at the Ground Truth Project. We cover war too much. We're not covering the forces that are shaping the world, that are forcing these people to flee. Some of that is war. Many of these immigrants are coming out of Libya, coming across over to Italy. A lot of them are coming, though, from Africa, where it's about income inequality, where it's about a devastating economy, where there's very little opportunity for people. We need to look at global issues like migration and the desperation they create to force people onto perilous seas in rickety boats, where they are at the mercy of these people who abuse them, treat them terribly, put them in the hulls of ships. And have you heard about this gradation of where you sit? That they're taking.
No.
So some people pay more money and sit at the top. Others, you have to pay for a life preserver. It is really heinous what's going on. And I think migration is an issue we don't cover enough. So again, tomorrow night, we got a chance to talk about all these issues, future of international news here, and I'm really glad you guys are going to be joining
us. We're thrilled. Very excited about the whole
Charlie,
thing.
Charlie, good to see you.
Charlie,
good luck tomorrow night.
Thank you very much. Thank 6 o'clock tomorrow night, open to everybody now listening to us.
And by the way, the marathon continues. We have reporters all over the race route, but if you want to follow up-to-minute news, and by the way, an American woman is leading in the women's race, an American man whom I never heard of, this guy Ritzenhine, was leading until a minute ago, you can get all that news and photos at WGBHnews.org. What's coming up, Marjorie?
What's coming up is presidential contenders serve up a lot of red meat in New Hampshire over the weekend. Who had the choicest cuts? That's next on our political roundup.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. And once again, Americans are leading both legs, men and women's marathon. This guy, Dathan Ritzenhine, who I cannot tell a lie, I've never heard of. He is the man leading on, obviously, that side of the race. And this woman, Desiree Linden, is leading on the women's side. And again, if you go to WGBHnews.org, you get up to the minute. Race status and photos and all that sort of thing.
I think the American man has a real chance here. You know why, Jim?
High socks.
No.
Why?
He's got a cute little cap on.
He does
Nike
have a nice
cap.
Little cap. In any case, that's always the key. So over the weekend, I don't know, 19, 20 Republicans, a mix of presidential candidates and some potential ones, hit New Hampshire to try out their talking points and their Hillary Clinton attack lines. Here's some of it.
As I was coming up, I was a little bit startled. Because I could have sworn I saw Hillary's Scooby-Doo van outside. Well, and then I realized it couldn't possibly be that, because I'm pretty sure y'all don't have any foreign nations paying speakers, right?
This listening tour is something out of North Korea. Would you like to meet the dear leader and ask him anything you would like?
I'm starting to worry that when Hillary Clinton travels, there's going to need to be two planes, one for her and her entourage and one for her baggage.
But I'm bummed. That was Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, and Rand Paul. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on the fledgling presidential race. Only 10 months, 9.5 months to go to New Hampshire. And other political headlines are Mike Astrew and John Nucci. John is the former head of the Social Security Administration. John is not the former head of the Social Security Administration. He's vice president of external affairs at Suffolk. Mike and John, good to see you both.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, of course, this is ridiculously early, but everyone was jumping on Hillary and, by extension, I suppose, Barack Obama about their horrible foreign policy. That seems to be – there seem to be going more foreign, less domestic, at least this first shot out of the box.
Yeah. I you know, at some point, they're going to have to stop doing that, though.
Yeah.
You know, why?
Well, because they have to distinguish themselves from their opponents in the primary at some point. And, you know, it's great to sort of portray this right now as – if you liked Barack Obama, you'll love Hillary Clinton. They're sort of making it, you know, Barack Obama's third term if you elect Hillary Clinton. And that's going to work for a while. It gets some sound bites. But at some point, there's a whole bunch of white men in this race, and they've got to distinguish themselves from each other. And that's going to be very difficult for them to do, I think.
The only distinguishing thing, I think, at least from having read accounts, Mike Astrew, is Rand Paul seems to be returning to his semi-isolationist roots. I mean, is that not the only standout in terms of the foreign policy thing? It's basically a bunch of one-liners, no?
Well, I also think that this is a you know, a temporary thing in a marathon of a campaign, and I tend to agree with James Carville that Americans very rarely decide their presidential preferences based on foreign policy. So I think this is, you know, the
economy stupid. Still?
I think so, and I think it will be. By the time people get serious about voting.
Why is Scott Walker leading in virtually every – former governor, obviously. Why is he leading in virtually every poll I've seen in New Hampshire? I would have assumed that virtually nobody even knew who he was,
right,
at least this early on. And every poll I've seen, he's ahead. And the most recent one I saw, he actually has the largest lead I've seen this whole race.
He's very articulate. He's got a good backstory.
Whoops, current governor. My apologies. I said former.
Yeah,
my apologies. Yeah,
right. He's got a good backstory. You know, he came from a pretty gritty urban backdrop. He, you know, he's playing that off against Jeb Bush and some of the others as well. But he's done that fairly skillfully, and he's had a good record in Wisconsin from a Republican point of view. He took on the public employees, you know, took on the teachers union and won.
You know, I'm smiling at you, and I had a fear you thought I was laughing at you. The thing that puts me over the edge, whether it's Hillary Clinton's I'm dead broke when I'm leaving the White House when I just signed an $8 million book contract. The latest was Scott Walker. I don't know if you guys have heard this. He buys all his shirts at Kohl's for a dollar. And when someone asked him about this dollar, I can relate to this latter part, asked him about his dollar shirts, are you wearing a Kohl's dollar? He said, not only am I wearing that, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm wearing a 3-for-1 Joseph A. Banks suit. You know, and by the way, I looked him up on politicalnetwork.com. He's worth $2 bucks. This faux... I grew up, as Marjorie says, every Democrat ever run in Massachusetts, you can relate to this, John. His mother was a washerwoman. His father worked for the Teamsters and was a truck driver or whatever it was. I mean, this faux poverty thing while growing up, doesn't it put you over the edge? It does me in a bipartisan way.
Yeah, I mean, if it's true, it's a good story. If it's fabricated, it's not a wise thing to do. You know, I don't think it's necessary for candidates to do that. And I want to take that point and sort of bring it over to Hillary Clinton for a second. Because I don't understand why, you know, people are criticizing her necessarily for being arrogant and aloof and sort of not getting down into the nitty-gritty and meeting people. Frankly, if I were Hillary Clinton, I'd probably adopt that strategy. Yes, I am political.
Why people are overrated? Is that
well,
what
no,
it is?
No. I think she's probably wise to run as a celebrity because she is a celebrity. Does anybody really think that over the last 4 or 5 years she's been dropping in on gas stations? You know, does anybody really believe that? No, and nobody's going to believe that. So you know what? If I were Hillary Clinton, I'd arrive with a bevy of limousines. I'd play the celebrity card.
Well, but John, how can you say that and then suggest that this faux listening tour thing, you know, sitting in kitchens, meeting with smart, I mean, that's not what celebrities do either. So you can't have it both ways, right?
But it's good video. It's good video, right? And let's face it, that's what campaigning is to a great degree, is video and audio sound bites, and that works well.
Well, there is a sense of a voter getting insulted. And because she is a celebrity, and you know that she doesn't normally go to Chipotle, and you know she doesn't do these other things that she's pretending to do, it does sort of insult your intelligence a little bit because it's so fake on the face of it. On the other hand, I think Rand Paul, who did criticize the Republicans for saying they'd have troops in every country, by now, if we listened to them when they were all talking about how lousy a job Obama was doing in foreign policy, he's going to stop making the jokes about Hillary Clinton and her baggage and stuff. It always amazes me how a lot of male candidates or men in general think they can make jokes about women and that women aren't voting and that women don't relate to that. You know, I don't think he needed to talk about her extra baggage.
Well, but you know, she is running for president. She's the presumptive nominee. You know, it was kind of sad when we couldn't make the Jimmy Carter jokes anymore. I mean, I don't know that she should be treated any differently.
What kind of jokes?
We had Carter jokes, you know, from coming out of the Reagan administration for years.
For whom, by the way, as a young man, Mike Oster worked,
right,
Ronald
yeah.
Reagan.
It wasn't until about 1986 that we realized, it's a little too late for the Carter joke. So she shouldn't be above the ordinary humor of the political process. And, you know, she shouldn't be
unique.
Above... Well, no, she's not. She is a candidate for president. You know, the same scrutiny that other candidates get. This is the sense that she's above the rules is a big problem with the campaign. This is why we got the scandal, you know, with her. With her emails, the sense that she's above the rules.
But I want to make sure you understand what I'm saying. What I'm saying is she's unique because she's the woman. I mean, we may have Carly Fiorina on the other side. But if you're making jokes about grandmothers and baggage and hairdos...
First of all, the baggage joke is about her Secretary of State baggage. It's not about her needing to carry extra items.
I think you can interpret it both ways. I really can. I think you got to be careful
with
that.
Well, she's bragged about the amount of travel that she's done. And one of the candidates, I don't remember who it was, said, you know, that's actually not an achievement. That's just, you know, a metric. And so, you know, to the extent that that's what you're talking about, you know, her bragging about how many miles she logged to Secretary of State, that's fair game. I mean, are there certain things that are off limits because she's a woman? Sure. And I think that probably people are treading a little bit more broadly than they would for a male candidate.
John looks like he's going to jump out of his skin here.
Yeah, but you know something? I mean, I think we reach a level of campaigning that we all want when we no longer consider her unique because she's a woman. Let's just stay away from that altogether. I do, you know, I see her. I'd like to see her, and I'd like other voters to see her as a former Secretary of State who's running for president. Not unusual. Happens a lot. She's not unique just because she's a woman.
And by the way, if you read Maureen Dowd, who admitted, the New York Times, who admittedly can't stand Hillary Clinton, she makes the case that people like Mark Penn and her husband suggested that Hillary Clinton run like a man, as a man last time. And this time, the grandmother thing, she's the one who's positioning herself as the woman candidate in the field, not to suggest she doesn't believe she has other qualifications, but she's essentially setting the stage. But can I move? I waited 10 minutes to get to the point that I really care about.
It does show the broader problem.
Which is?
That she's not really about anything. It's about listening to the advisors, following the polls, and remaking herself in what she thinks will be expedient.
That's shocking in politics,
but
isn't it?
But much more
unlike
so.
Unlike the Republicans.
Well,
who don't do it.
You know.
You know, but let's get to – I do this every 4 years, and I'll probably do it 20 more times before January comes. When I see 19 Republicans who want to lead the free world in New Hampshire, and I see the woman who's allegedly going to win the Democratic nomination and walk away, I say to myself, and with all due respect, I love New Hampshire. We're Marjorie and I are coming up in January for a week. The fact that Iowa and New Hampshire essentially decide – who's out? If they may not decide who the nominee is, they surely decide who the nominee will not be, is to me appalling. How many major cities in Iowa and New Hampshire, Mike Astrew?
It depends on your definition of major.
Top 50 in America.
None.
Right. Zero. How about racial diversity? None. Yeah. I mean, the notion that these two little outlying kinds of states, and there have been Iowa, New Hampshire is wonderful, but it is, and it's an aberrational kind of thing. Already they're saying if Jeb Bush doesn't win New Hampshire, he is essentially has to drop out of the race. It is clear that 6 years ago, if Barack Obama, after having won Iowa, beat Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, most people think, I included, the race was over. Why do we give so much clout to little tiny states that are not representative of this country, Mike Astrew?
Well, I agree that we need to rethink the process. And it's not just, you know, substituting one state for New Hampshire.
Regional primary, something.
We have a process that's designed for 1920 when, you know, it took a while, you know, to get around state by state and that type of thing. I think that we should be moving the whole primary process much later. I mean, it shouldn't start before June and end a little bit of this permanent campaign. And I think there's some value to retail politicking, testing the candidates. I'm not for like two or three super primaries, but I think we should be compressing this all into a very small period of time, much later in the election.
Can I, before you get your two cents, John, let me respond to the some value to retail politicking. I think there's no value to retail politicking because as leader of the free world and as the most powerful person on the planet, you never do retail politicking except when you're lobbying, if you do, 535 members of Congress. Why judge someone on skills that are not relevant to how he or she will do the job? How is it relevant how they do sitting in a room with four people at a diner in Nashua?
Because you see the real person. And if everything is done through television the way you would campaign in New York or California, you don't get as good a chance to see the real person. You get the moments, good and bad. You know, Muskie breaking down and crying right. In New Hampshire and things like that that tell you something important about the person. You know, you saw, you know, the Reagan moment seizing the microphone.
Yeah.
The things that change. And you don't see that if it's all, you know, if it's all like Robert Redford and the candidate in California, you don't see
pretty
those things.
Movie. How about it, John?
I think the fact that it's a popular vote in New Hampshire is a good thing. I think New Hampshire is an appropriate size to do that type of retail politicking. I do think retail politicking is important. You know, you're not applying for a job here. You're looking for the trust and the nod from voters to be their leader. To do that, you have to meet them. You have to talk to them. They have to listen to you. Voting is not always a cerebral experience. It's an emotional one. People vote based upon emotions. So having New Hampshire be granted a small, not necessarily representative state where a first primary is held, I don't think is that disastrous. I mean,
but do you both of you are sort of making – do you both not agree that Iowa and New Hampshire are determinative states? If one person wins both the caucus and the primary,
They're also very different states. So even though they're both small and they're predominantly white and stuff, is Iowa so evangelical? I mean, Mike Huckabee, who did quite well actually in 2008 in the primary season, is focusing primarily on Iowa because he's a big evangelical and he could win there again. So they're different. You don't have that huge Christian right populace.
And I'm not sure it's that determinative. You know, we've got a lot of media these days. It's not like the old days where you'd have a primary in New Hampshire. That would be people's first exposure to the candidates, and there'd be an order of finish, and it gets locked into their mind, and they carry it through the election. You know, it's a bounce right now. It's a very big bounce because all eyes are on New Hampshire. But that can change. But the media coverage of all the upcoming caucuses and primaries, that can change over time.
Well, let me try one more thing, and then I'll shut up on this thing. The first four contests, we mentioned Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. None of the four, and I think we would argue the further it goes, the more determinative they have potential to be, none of them have one of the 25 biggest cities in America. And I would argue in 2015, not hearing from major cities during the time in which a candidate is chosen is, I mean this word, is an abomination. It is so totally unrepresentative of what this country is.
Another cycle or two in Las Vegas is probably there.
True.
But in Nevada,
Clark County, you're right, in America.
And Nevada and South Carolina are much more racially diverse than the other two.
That is true.
So if you look at it a little bit more broadly, it's not as bad as it seems at first. But I don't think there's anything magic about Iowa and New Hampshire. And I think we need to have a broader debate about what's the right way to pick the president of the United States.
So is Kelly Ayotte, the senator from New Hampshire, going to be the vice presidential candidate for somebody, you think?
I think that's quite possible.
Yeah.
You do think it's quite possible?
Yeah, I do.
What's the because of its, what is that, three electoral votes? Is that what it is up there?
Well, but I think
she's
that
girl.
I think that the recent track record is that vice president candidates are not very good at even bringing in their own state.
That's true.
And so it's a
Al Gore, how are you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's a broader statement about
He was a presidential
about diversity, about positions, preparedness to lead, all kinds of things like that. And I think that she's going to be on the short list. I think Rob Portman will be on the short list.
Ohio.
I think there'll be, you know, a good group of candidates there.
We're talking politics with Mike Astrew and John Nucci. That conversation continues. We're going to get a little bit more local coming up after this on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. By the way, the two Americans who were leading in the men's and women's races are not leading anymore. If you want the latest, you go to WGBHnews.org. Up-to-the-minute status of the runners, photos, that sort of thing. And speaking of up-to-the-minute status, we are now joined, I have no idea where he is, by our colleague, Philip Martin. Where are you, Philip?
Yeah. Hey there, Jim. I'm close to the finish line, of course. That's where they put the media. Not exactly at the finish line. That's part of the security arrangement. They're keeping that finish line clear only for those who work the race and for those who are obviously running the race. There are hundreds of people streaming toward the finish line. Most won't get anywhere near it because there are so many people here. But moments ago, you could see a stream of people coming from the subways at Arlington and Boylston Street, and they're heading in this direction. As I speak with you right now, people are just lining up. No one seems to be deterred by history or deterred by the weather, which is pretty awful today, by the way.
You sound totally breathless, Philip. Are you jogging alongside the runners, or what's going on?
It's so funny you said that. I was actually trying to get the best spot possible. And so you're right. Huh. I've been running from block to block, trying to get the best spot possible. And those spots are taken up by my colleagues who are very good at taking photographs and video. They have the priority. It's a visual race, and they are and they're taking up the conquest of the spaces.
We assume, though, that despite the security, there are certainly media on that that overhang on Boylston Street where all the photographers are to get the finishers coming across. So they got the credentials to get in there so we can get those great pictures, I assume.
You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They and of course, the official photographers for the BAA, they are given the priority.
Hey, Philip, overall, I mean, I know the weather is not great today. What are the crowds like?
You know, these crowds are vibrant. You would never know it's overcast, that it's on the brink of raining, and you would never know that it's actually in the 40s out here today because this is like a summer crowd. People are animated. They're talking to one another like strangers during an emergency, and everyone seems to be having a good time. Lots of Gatorade being drunk, and lots of water being consumed, and a lot of high fives even before the races get to the finish line.
And by the way, it appears the women are approaching you pretty quickly. I think actually a matter of minutes until you're going to see the lead pack of women. And I should say the good news is it appears that there are three or four women who are within a yard or two of each other, so it should be a pretty good finish.
Yeah, the ending should be great.
Hey, Philip, thank you for calling in. We really appreciate it. Philip Martin.
Absolutely.
Pretty close to the finish line there.
So we're here with Mike Astor, former head of the Social Security Administration, and John Nucci, vice president of government relations and community affairs at Suffolk University. We're talking politics for the next couple of minutes. We had Charlie Baker in here, the governor, the other day, and he was saying, you know, we asked him about his first 100 days, and he gave himself pretty good marks. And many people think that the snowstorm helped him instead of hurting him. John Nucci, what do you think? You're a Democrat. What do you think about the Republicans' first 100 days?
I think they've been pretty good, actually. And I think a sort of overall important area where he's excelled is in sort of reaching across the aisle and establishing relationships with the Democratic leadership of the House and the Senate. That's a good start. That doesn't always happen. And
yeah.
I think he's been very, very skillful at doing that and cultivating relationships, particularly with Speaker DeLeo, where I sense a real synergy. There seems to be a willingness to work together there. So I think sort of as a macro approach for the first 100 days, he's done a good job. You know, in large part, like Mayor Walsh, the agenda was dictated, you know, by the snowstorm, by the T. He would not have predicted the MBTA would have been on his top of his list in his first 100 days, but it was, and it drove the agenda. I think he's done okay with that, but it's his now. He owns it, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Well, you know, I would have agreed anyway with what John Nucci said, Mike Astor, about the almost a bipartisan love fest. In fact, Democrats in the BUR poll that came out last week, 59-19 approval. However, you read now that the two transportation chairs, Bill Strauss in the House, Tom McGee in the Senate, are basically saying, and I'm putting words in their mouth, hey, we understand transportation too, Mr. Governor. Instead of this financial control board, what do we need that for? Why isn't the governor taking over authority so that there's an identifiable person? They're also, at least the House chair, Bill Strauss, is talking about there's got to be a revenue component to this fix, essentially, and I'm putting words here again, but he seems to be saying, let's not put off the inevitable. Let's get down to it right now. So it appears to be the Democrats flexing their muscles on this critical issue, no?
Yes, and I agreed with everything that John said until he got to his last sentence, because I don't think Charlie Baker owns this until the legislature gives him more ability to deal with this. And I and a lot of people, I think, were very perturbed at the attitude of the chairman. It's basically, you know, we boys don't think that we want to do things anything differently. You know, that's kind of the way it came across.
Was that Marlon Brando, by the way?
Yeah, somewhere in that, as best I can do. And I think it's a challenge not only to Charlie Baker, it's a challenge to John Fish. Because
head of the Olympics.
Because the people in Boston realize we can't do the Olympics unless we fix transportation. And we can't fix transportation if these same people who've been running this run it the same way. And if anybody should be getting out there lobbying the legislature to support the control board, it should be John Fish.
But why should there be a control? I thought the point they made in the story, which I'm embarrassed I hadn't thought about, forget the control board. Let Charlie Baker, as we suggested, let him replace, even though statutorily he can't do it, they have to agree to do it, let him replace the whole board, let him nominate all seven people, and let the governor essentially be where the buck stops instead of some board that no one ever heard of.
The problem is that the legislative chairman have sent a signal to the board people, you don't need to resign. We don't see any need for anything other than business as usual. And if that stands, John Fish might as well just give it up, because people are going to say, if we can't even fix the transportation problem, never mind the other things, I mean, we're just going to be making a joke of ourselves if we go forward with this Olympic bid. So, but the problem with Fish is he's got the guy that led this transportation.
Rich Davey
telling him, oh, well, you know, I don't know what he's telling him, but it's going to be hard for him to say, yeah, we were a failure for 10 years. We need to do things differently.
By the way, we're still getting tweets and emails. Rich Davey did cancel his appearance here a week or so ago, and we are waiting for him to reschedule, as are apparently you.
John Nucci, it does seem to me that the Olympics people should be hammering home the idea that they're going to do more than bring in extra red line cars and orange line cars, which is what Davey said last time we did speak to him, and do something dramatic about the T, meshing it. But they're not.
You're talking about the MBTA people, not the Olympics.
Well, it seems to me that if you are opposed to the Olympics and you're very nervous about them, and you think it's going to be a boondoggle, as some people like myself do, I'd be less inclined to feel that way if I thought the T and the Olympics were linked. And they're only linked in this little tiny way. They're not linked in a big way.
Right. But, you know, the T is not the only problem that the Olympics face. It's one of them. It's a big one.
You're right.
And there are broader issues and more important issues. And I think we would all agree that the biggest issue the Olympic faces is that people are worried the tax revenue is going to be spent on the Olympics. Now,
but don't you think if the average person who has a problem with this Olympics thought that the Olympic movement was going to be the leverage that got the T finally brought into the 21st century, that a lot of the opposition might at least be limited? By the way, the women's race is over. Caroline Routish, she's from Kenya, won the race. Desiree Linden from the U.S. came in fourth.
She ran a great race, by the way.
She did. Quickly, John, don't you think that's true?
It would help, but I honestly think the Olympics need to change the whole narrative. And you know what I think it should be?
No.
What's wrong with spending public money on the Olympics?
It's a little late. That train has left the station.
We're spending it today for a marathon. So what's wrong with spending some public money?
I think we'll be spending a little bit more, I suspect. Don't you think?
It'll bring it a little bit more.
John and Mike, good to see you.
Thank you both for being here. Mike Astro, former head of the Social Security Administration. For both the Bush and Obama administrations, John Nucci, VP of Government Relations and Community Affairs at Suffolk University. Thank you guys both for coming in. Up next, I'm going to ask you about the marathon. Does seeing wave upon wave of runners inspire you to get into the race? Or do you look at them and say, that's great, forget about it? That's up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We'll kick off the noon hour of today's Boston Public Radio with a man who won the marathon in 1968, and he's the oldest champion running today, Amby Burfoot joins us.
We'll ask you if all those skinny marathon runners bouncing down Boylston Street inspire you next year, or do you say, hey, they're great, but forget it. It's also Patriots Day, and we'll give every marathon caller a question from our brilliant Patriots Day quiz. Then the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price on Apple's racially diverse emoji. Then TV guru Bob Thompson on a scandal involving the great late Lucille Ball, and all this swearing on TV. We'll ask you, is there too much swearing on TV, in the office, at home with your kids? Mom and Dad, are you inspiring your toddlers to drop F-bombs at the supermarket? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH on Marathon Day. And we're watching a pretty exciting finish to this race between the two men finalists coming down to the wire.
From Ethiopia, this guy, Lalisa Desiza, is winning. Meb Kefleski, if that's how you pronounce it, I think I got it right, who won last year, is not in the final two. And if you go to WGBHnews.org or you listen to us, we'll tell you who the winner is, and it's just a couple of minutes away.
Yeah, he's just coming into the underpass on Commonwealth Avenue, coming down toward Hereford Street, so it's pretty exciting. Or actually, would it be Gloucester? Where would they take the right? I don't know where they take the right.
But in any case, more than 30,000 people you know ran today. Should one of those people in the future be you? You know, all weekend, Marjorie and I both commented, runners swarm the city. They're trotting around, buying up bananas, stretching, wearing the official marathon gear. Does seeing this concentration of athletes get you thinking, next year, that's going to be me. Our number is 877-301-8970. Use someone who got tired of being on the sidelines. Have you taken the marathon challenge, or have you realized the time has come and gone? 877-301-8970. Follow your marathon dreams and, I guess, nightmares here. 877-301-8970. Everybody who calls, by the way.
He just took off his hat to see. So I was coming around the corner. So he had a Nike cap on the whole way, but I guess he's warmed up enough at 26 miles.
I think he switched sponsors. In any case, everybody who calls will get to participate in our Patriots Day Marathon Day quiz. 877-301-8970. You know, this is unscientific. Every time there's a marathon, it's usually the next day you see more runners who are out of shape, myself usually included, than you see on marathon day. Everybody decides next year's marathon is the marathon for them because all this excitement is created. And we want to know if you're part of that group. And by the way, before we take your phone calls, on Friday when we were here, I issued a challenge to Marjorie Egan. Marjorie has been pretending for years that the two marathons she ran, she finished faster than the two New York City marathons I ran. We both pledged to bring documentation. I'd like to say I have brought documentation.
We both didn't pledge to bring
documentation. And I would like to say, I'm speaking about this right now.
Okay.
I'd like to say that in 19-whatever, I can't read the year, but I can see I finished New York City Marathon. Do I have the right one? Yes, I did. I finished New York City Marathon, Marjorie, in 3 hours.
Yeah.
39 minutes and 56 seconds.
Okay.
And in light of the fact you do not have a document, I would say this pretty much ties it up that I have the fastest
really
marathon
tie
time.
It up because I actually got a number and qualified to run the Boston Marathon because I finished in less than 3 hours.
Where's your
minutes.
Documentation?
Well, our crack staff is looking it up right now.
Oh, you don't have it, though.
I don't have it because you didn't. I would like to point out, though, that I did finish third in the Lake Champlain Island Marathon.
Yeah, sure
Jim, did you ever finish in the top 10?
Well, actually, I have documentation that I did finish, which is more than you. 339.56, as of the moment, that is the record for Boston Public Radio. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Oh,
we want to know how you are reacting to today's race. Again, my unscientific sampling of people. And by the way, this guy, Lalisa DeCisa, has just crossed
just
the finish line. Relatively slow time for
19.
Like that.
He looks terrific.
From Ethiopia. We want to know what impact this is having on you. Again, my unscientific sampling is it always causes people to decide, I want to do that marathon one time. And we want to know if you're amongst them or if you've decided, as I said before, that your time has come and gone. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
I would like to point out, so I don't look like I'm, you know, being bragging needlessly here, the only reason I finished third in the Lake Champlain Island Marathon among the women is because there were almost no women in the race.
Yeah, but Marjorie, can I just
say, there were seven women. I finished third.
In light of the fact that you have no documentation of your finish, I would like to say I won the New York City Marathon 7 years in a row. Now, I have no documentation for that either, but why not? I do have documentation for a 339.56. I went online and got it at the New York City
Marathon.
Okay,
our crack staff is looking online.
Well, you could have done the same thing for your
marathons. I forgot, Jim. I didn't realize you were actually going to bring in your documentation. I should point out before we take your calls that Jim has a massive picture of himself coming across the finish line in the New York City Marathon above his desk, which seems to be a little bit much.
I did not
purchase a massive picture of myself finishing the various marathons I ran when I was young, but it's okay. But no one cares about us. Let's hear about you. 877-301-8970. Now, I will point out, if you want to run the marathon, you know what the problem with running a marathon is?
No, I don't.
That you kind of have to train a lot.
You do.
You know, you have to kind of
That's why people are going out today and tomorrow.
On Sunday, you know, and run like 18 miles, which takes a lot of time. So if you have like a spouse or young children or a job, I mean, it makes it more difficult to spend all this time running. But if you do run a lot, then for the rest of your life, you can brag, as Jim and I are bragging, at cocktail parties or on the radio, wherever you are, that you ran a marathon. You can feel like a big deal.
I would suggest if you're going to brag about having finished a marathon, you should have documentation like I do. 877-301-8970. Is this inspiring you, or are you basically saying it's great to see these world-class runners? And it's also great to see some just average weekend runners that are running for charity, but this is not for me. You know what's hard for me to believe?
What?
It's hard for me. When I lived in New York City, I really wanted to run the New York City Marathon, and I did.
Yeah.
If I had grown up here, it seems to me I would have had an obsession with running the Boston Marathon once. You're a local kid. You grew up in Fall River.
I know. It's one of my biggest regrets.
How come you didn't run?
Because I wanted a number. I didn't want to run like a faker.
I thought you were fast enough if you did what you allegedly did.
I told you this story a million times.
What is it, please?
I got the number with my best high school friend who at the time smoked a pack of cigarettes a day. Mm-hmm. She also qualified for the Boston Marathon.
So what happened?
She ran the Boston Marathon. I qualified and I moved to Vermont. People can appreciate this. Over the wintertime, I was like 45 minutes from the Canadian border and it never got above zero and there was like 9 feet of snow. Mm-hmm. And I didn't train well enough, so it was one of my biggest regrets. But I would also like to point out that, you know, here's one of the things, and this is a good thing for you to remember, Jim, that one of the great things about marathon running, it takes absolutely no coordination. You can be the worst athlete in the world.
I would agree with that.
And you can
takes training,
run
that's
a
all
marathon.
It takes.
So if you were the person that was, you know, never picked on the baseball team, never picked on the volleyball team, on your Red Rover team in second grade, if nobody wanted you to participate in their Rover side, this is your opportunity because you can be a total uncoordinated person and run the marathon and finish the marathon.
By the way, Meb just crossed the finish line well behind the winner. But as he's crossing the finish line, I don't think he knew this woman. There's a woman about to finish. He grabs her hand and they clench hands and raise them up to the sky as they cross. 877-301-8970. So how is the running of the race? What impact is it having on you, if any, in terms of your plans to be a Boston marathoner in the future? And by the way, if you want to comment on the fact, even though it isn't part of our formal agenda, that I have documentation that I ran two marathons and Marjorie has no documentation of her alleged three.
How long, feel free to, excuse me, how long did it take you to get this documentation? Was this like a 2-hour endeavor?
No, it took about 30 seconds.
30
you go
seconds.
To a website, you type in your name, and if you could have done the same for your marathons.
Well, my crack
obviously
staff,
you chose
have you
not,
not
to.
Have you not found
it's
me
not
yet
your
back
crack
there?
Staff. It's your coworkers. Lorraine, you're in Worcester. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, how are you?
We're excellent, thank you.
Yeah, well, I've never been inspired to run.
Why?
Run a marathon. I'm not disciplined. I think it requires a certain discipline or...
Oh, it does.
Maybe, yeah, and I'm aware that I'm not a disciplined person for any kind of physical activity. I'll try yoga, I'll try Qigong, I'll try, you know, run the beach a little bit. But I'm never disciplined to do one particular thing. I admire people who can do it. I was shocked to learn that my niece did it a few years ago, 2 years ago. And I'm inspired for people, and I applaud them for doing it. I'll go and watch it as a spectator once in a while. But never inspired.
You know, Lorraine, it's a very thoughtful.
I think it hurts your body.
Well, actually, if you train adequately, as someone who has a body prone to being hurting, it didn't hurt me, except for a few days. Lorraine, since you sound like a thoughtful person, what do you think about the fact that Marjorie chose not to bring documentation of her three marathons?
I think she's wise.
Okay. Now, here's a question.
There you go.
Here's
Hold
a Patriots
on.
Day quiz. Here's
Hold
the quiz.
On. Before we get to the quiz,
yeah.
Paul just emailed and said, Jim posted his New York City marathon
you know
picture.
What? I go by her word.
Lorraine, well, that's one of us.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead, Marjorie, go.
On the BPR Facebook page?
I did not.
He says, well, it might be a picture
Somebody
for Hair Club
have.
For Men.
Okay, so here is the, what was the first Boston, when was the first Boston marathon held, Lorraine? That's your question.
I wouldn't know.
Well, take a guess. You don't have to train for this. Take a guess.
Let's see. I don't know. Probably 40 years ago?
Well, you're only off by 79 years. So that was actually a good guess. It was 1897. Lorraine, thank you much for the call. 877-301-8970. Is there a picture of me finishing the marathon on the Facebook page? We do. If you go to the Facebook page, I had a little more hair then. It was
Wait
a different
a
color.
Wait
I didn't
minute.
Put it up. I didn't put it up.
You did not put it up?
No, I did not. I did not. I swear to you. I don't even know how to put it up.
I don't believe that for a second.
So have you posted any pictures of Marjorie finishing any marathons or you have not? Apparently not. Let's go to Simon. You're in Brighton. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Simon. How are you?
Hi, Simon.
Hey, I'm good. How are you doing?
We're great. Thank you.
Yeah, so I love the Boston Marathon and I hate to pour cold water on it.
Go right ahead. It's okay.
But I'm going to. So they shut down the roads like much earlier than they usually do. I couldn't get home from work this morning. A number of other people were being diverted. Basically, if the leaders of the city can't run a world-class event without shutting down the city, much like they put us on lockdown during the Tsarnaev debacle, then really there's no place for having something like the Olympics here. Really, it may be good for our world standing, but really for residents of the city, it's a nightmare.
You know, that's a great point, Simon. You wouldn't be able to get home for a month. Right?
By the way, that is a question they're going to have to answer. So, Simon, Marjorie can relate to your concern about traffic disruption because that's why she doesn't like all the
Simon,
walks down her street. But
how did you get – what did you do? Did you have to leave your car somewhere and walk, or what did you do?
Well, the police were fairly helpful, except they didn't have any street directions for me. They were going to let me leave my car and walk across, but then they let me – they said drive back out to Newton to 128 and cross there and see if I could wend my way back through Route 2. So basically I went to Wilson's diner in Waltham and had had brunch there.
So it's not a total loss. Now, Simon, before you go away, we learned that the first marathon was in 1897. Here's our second Patriots Day quiz. How many runners participated in that first marathon in 1897? How many was that?
Oh, 1897 runners.
Was
1,897.
197, that was actually, I thought you had it when you said 18 and then paused 97. The answer is 18 runners in the first marathon in 1897. Thank you, Simon, very much for your call. 877-301-8970. We forgot to ask him if he was inspired by this.
I don't think he sounded very inspired, Jim. He was
upset about
not
marathon.
Being able to get home and the fact that he was had to drive out to, where did he have to drive out to Newton or something
Waltham.
At 128?
You know, one of my favorite moments, you know, talk about Marjorie doing an April Fool's thing on me that worked 16 years in a row until this year. Here's what happened every single year of the marathon. I would leave our old radio job, which was on Morrissey Boulevard, right next to the Globe, and maybe 4 hours later, I would call her saying, I've been trying to get to NECN for 4 hours, forgetting that the marathon was in its way.
Get
it really
across
is.
The route.
No, by the way, you know, Simon raised a point that is a legitimate one. We do need to hear from the Olympics people as to what sort of shutdown would be necessary and of what parts of the city.
It's a month long.
No, I'm serious. I mean,
well, you figure they're going to have the big stadium is going to be down in Whitett Circle. Have you ever pronounced that down there?
Well,
off 93, so that'll be shut down. They're going to have volleyball in the Boston Common.
They're not
going to
have it on
down.
Boston. They're not going to have it on Boston.
They're going to have rowing out in Lowell, so the entire entrances to and from Lowell be
shut
down.
No, I'm serious. I know you're being your usual cynical self. Instantly, the top American finishers, the women's top finisher was Desiree Linden. She came in fourth. Top American men, Dathan Ritzenheim.
I think that was the guy we saw.
Yeah, he was leading for a lot of the way. He came in seventh, and the winner of last year, Meb Kefleski, I hope I got it right again, came in ninth. 877-301-8970. What we're trying to find out is whether or not you're inspired by today's mass of athleticism throughout the city, starting in Hopkinton, and if it's going to inspire you. You know, by the way, I'm trying to think back. I actually think when I started training for marathons I did. I think it was from the prior year's New York City marathon, actually. I think it got you really psyched. You saw him running throughout the city, and you all of a sudden say, maybe I could do that too. How about you?
I told you what inspired me.
What was it again?
Well, I had a boyfriend with a drinking problem who used to run off his hangovers.
Oh, that's so you had to run
and
with him.
So I would run with him, and then he said, you should come and run a marathon with me because, you know, you're pretty fast. And so that was it. I think he stopped drinking now. I certainly hope he has.
Now, let me, if I could direct this question to any of our coworkers in the control room. You've been looking for Marjorie's results for about 25 minutes. What do you have so far, please? What do you have? Oh, we haven't found them, Chelsea said. I found mine
them.
In about 30 seconds on the New York City Marathon.
Maybe you should look up the Green Island. What was it called? The Lake Champlain Island? That's when I finished third in. Maybe we can get that one.
Lake Champlain, she allegedly finished third in a marathon. Third amongst women. But in any case,
we did beat the men.
It's only an hour and 40 minutes left in the show. Let's see if Marjorie
I would like
can
to point out one
results.
Thing while Jim is complaining about the fact that I didn't produce my results. We've been having a push-up challenge now for about 15 years.
We have.
Yes. Have we had the push-up challenge yet?
What did I say to you, Marjorie? I said, as soon as you provide your marathon finishing time, I will move on to push-ups. But I'm not going to start another competition while you have yet to produce what you've promised year after year.
Marlena from Chelsea. What do you think, Marlena? Are you going to run a marathon?
Hey there.
I'm 77 now, so I don't think I'm going to be running a marathon.
Well,
soon.
You could, though, but go ahead.
Well, I could, but the training that we're going, because let me put it this way, I would not want to just run it. I would want to win my age group, and probably that is a possibility, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why, have you run before?
I've run 11 marathons.
Oh, wow, good for you.
And I started running when I was 40. So I ran my first Boston in 79 and my second Boston in 80 when it was like in the, 70s or low 80s. I don't know, the ground heat was really. And I ran a 3:10:56 and actually I was, I think, 10th master. I'm not sure.
Wow, good
wow,
for you.
Wow, that is
good
amazing.
So do you still run, even if you're not running marathons? Do you still
get
out there?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm down to like 25 miles a week, but that's okay. You know,
good for you.
Time, you know. So it's
you're running 25 miles a week at 77?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. You know, people can do that if they want to.
That's fabulous.
You know, I mean, it just depends on what your desire
Marlena,
is.
Marlena, why'd you start running at, well, I don't know if you started running. Why did you do your first marathon at 40? Did you just take up running then, or what happened?
Yeah, I started running like in 78.
Mm-hmm.
And
there weren't very many women running then.
1978, yeah. It was like the blizzard of 78. I was running, and then I just wanted to run a marathon. I joined Cambridge Sports Union, and got Larry Berman's a great coach, and I just I wanted to do a marathon, and I also ran a 5:44 mile when I was
wow. Wow, you are fast.
Hey, Marlena, before you go away, what is the what's the age group? Is it 70 and over? Is there an 80 and over? What where does it?
You know, I'm pretty sure there's a 70 to 80. I'm not sure, really.
Well,
I know there are people running it in their 80s. God love them. So can I just tell you one thing,
what?
The reason I called?
Yeah.
I have a real problem with the fact that many people who qualify for this marathon now, since all the charity runners
don't
have been running, and, you know, they
go.
Don't get in for 4 or 5 hours.
Right?
I agree
so
with that.
Right. It's
I
not
so
right.
I agree about that.
Was well, there a story in the Wall Street Journal or something in the last couple of days? Yeah.
Because
yeah.
a lot of the people that qualify are really good runners. I mean, what is the
what is the
woman's qualification?
You know what I say? Get rid of the qualifying times and make it just what it is.
Which essentially, by the way, New York City is whoever gets accepted no matter what speed
yeah.
you run. And at least it was. I don't know if it is anymore.
Although, on the other hand, Marlene, that's one of the neat things about Boston, that it is a qualifying race. And
well,
so
but
you
it's
know
a hybrid, if, though.
It's a hybrid, but it seems to me they should cut down the number. Well, I can't say cut down the number of charity because they raise so much money for charity, but it's become almost more of a charity race than a runner's race in some ways.
Marlena, before you go away, here's your question. For many years, what was the
yeah.
only prize for winning the Boston Marathon?
A cup? I don't know.
No, the olive, the wreath thing, the wreath. What was the first year they offered a cash prize? Do you know?
Oh, gee, I think they had a cash prize when I ran it.
Well,
so.
Close. 1986. That's actually,
was it 86?
That's what it says here. All I know is this was handed me by our producers. I'm assuming, even though they can't find Marjorie's times, that they know what they're doing. Hey, Marlena, great call. We'll hope you do it again at 78. And if you do, let us know. Thanks so much for your call. 877-301-8970. How many people have you found so far who are inspired by today's runners to go?
I don't think we found anyone.
Would you, by the way, you know, I have mixed feelings. When you see everybody around in their little marathon jacket starting three, would you wear your marathon jacket?
Oh, if I were in it now
yeah.
and I got it legitimately with a number,
yeah.
absolutely.
I occasionally, over the weekend, I got aggravated when I saw everybody. And then I said to myself, I'm aggravated because I don't have one. But clearly, had I qualified or were I running this year, I'd be wearing that thing like to sleep.
I'm sure you would be, Jim.
Thank you.
Dean on the road. What do you think, Dean?
Hi, Dean.
Hey, good morning. Or afternoon. I just wanted to put a plug in for people who cheer along the sides of the race route. I've run a few marathons myself and have gone to a whole bunch of them in obviously New York and Boston, which is close to me. But a lot of times people will be pretty quiet along the race route, believe it or not.
Wait, we lost the one word you said. Pretty what?
A lot of people will be very quiet along the race route, from what I've seen, and they'll do some, you know, they'll clap a little bit here and there. But the thing that is really helpful to runners is so many runners will wear a shirt that has their name on it, or the school they went to, or something like that.
Yell that out!
And from running myself, yell those things out. People love that, and a thumbs up. They'll give you a thumbs up that you cheered for them. And it makes a big difference when you're coming down to the last mile of a race to hear people yell your name.
Yeah,
that's
a great point. That is a great point, Dean. Thank you very much for that call.
You know, so on that note, and I'm not just doing this to celebrate my athletic achievements, one of the great things about New York City, and I have to say this may be one aspect that is better than Boston, people are cheering for the whole 26 miles. And one of the it runs through all five boroughs. Yeah. Or does it run through – I think it's all – yeah, it is all five boroughs because it starts in Staten Island on the other side of the Verrazano Bridge. You know what's great about it? Every single turn you make in the race, there's a different neighborhood. You'll run through a neighborhood where everybody watching the race are Hasidic Jews. You turn left, it's all African Americans. It's all these great neighborhoods. Everybody is wild for the whole route. So while Boston is probably America's number one marathon, New York City is a pretty great thing. You know, speaking of this marathon, we're rejoined on the phone near the finish line by our colleague, Philip Martin. Hey, Philip.
Jim, Marjorie, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
You know, I was just listening to you make a comparison, this juxtaposition to New York. And, you know, it's a good point, and I'll tell you why. I'm looking and feeling this crowd, and at some point, even like in proximity to the finish line, I can see the finish line, by the way. I can see people sitting in the stands. I can see people crossing the finish line. I saw Caroline crossing the finish line. I saw LaLisa.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's right, crossing the finish line. But the crowds are consistent, it seems. There are some people who are cheering wildly, and there are other people who are subdued. There's a huge part of the crowd that's subdued. So it's a bit of a reappraisal of what I told you earlier as I saw people high-fiving. I'm also seeing people shivering, and I'm also seeing people who have complained about the security. Not a lot of people, but to get into this to get to this race today, on Arlington Street, for example, you had to queue up for a long time in order to get past the police officers who are doing their jobs, who are trying to make people secure. But it is a bit of a I think it does put a damper on it, so to speak, for some people here.
When you say to get past the police officers, you mean because they were searching people?
Yeah, they're searching. They're searching bags. I have a bag. Yeah. Anyone who is with the media likely has a bag of some sort. And some people have purses, and some people have small bags. But they're searching everything, and making sure that this race is safe. That, of course, makes all the sense in the world in light of the history.
Well, when you combine the being searched with the crappy weather, I guess it's not so shocking that some people are subdued. But one thing, when we spoke to Commissioner Evans last week, and I've heard his public pronouncements, while they are searching people, there's not like a military kind of presence, right? They're fairly low-key despite the searches, aren't they, Philip, or are they?
That's absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head, Jim. It's low-key. No one's wearing – there are some officers, of course, wearing full gear, body gear. Those with the canine units and others who aren't seen by this crowd. But for the most part, these are police officers wearing their rain gear. They are low key, and they are there's nothing heavy handed going on here at all. I think it's just that you're right. The combination of rain clouds, rain, the dreariness of this day, I think, is impacting some individuals.
Well, it's been a lot of life in you, Philip. Philip Martin, thanks for sharing your observations. He's near the finish line of
Jim Marjorie, the
119th Boston Marathon. By the way, for whatever it's worth, and you can draw your own conclusions, the year that Marjorie said she came in third in the Lake Champlain, according to our colleagues who are searching, is the only year that is not available online.
Okay.
Now, that is really, what a coincidence that is,
okay.
Marjorie.
Okay. Okay.
By the way, the 2 years that I finished New York City, I don't know if I've mentioned this, actually are available online. And my top time was 3:39.56. And for a guy who's not much of an athlete, who is 6'5", I think that's rather impressive.
No, I think it was really impressive, especially since you started on mile 12.
And by the way, we have till 2 o'clock for Marjorie to come up with any documentation that she ever ran a marathon.
Okay, well, coming up, we're going to check in with someone who is actually unstoppable.
I love this guy.
Marathoner Amby Burford. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. So no elite marathoner stops 3/4 of a mile before crossing the finish line unless he has no say in the matter. That was the case with Amby Burford 2 years ago at 25 and a half miles into the Boston Marathon. He, along with so many thousands of others, was thwarted by the bombings. Amby Burfoot, who won the Boston Marathon in 1968, is back in Boston to run this year's race. Amby, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, a pleasure to talk to you as well, Amby. You know, before we get back to current events and what happened in 2013, I was fascinated by one of the stories I read about you when you're talking about running the race, you know, back in the late 60s and the year you won in 68. You said to the Globe, it was like Beacon Street was just jammed full of people. It was like Moses in the Red Sea. They opened and let me through, and then they jam all the way back into the middle of the road afterwards. And I thought, how different it was then than now. I mean, obviously, you could never do that now. So that's what it was like, a little narrow pathway to let you through?
Well, I think what's important to note is that the crowds and the support for the marathon were just as big on a sunny day, which it was in 1968, as they are now, but there was none of the traffic, the crowd control, the security, any of the things that are so much part of the race now, where it's almost gated start to finish. So it was a really hands-on experience back in the 60s.
Amby,
so.
when you were at the starting line, did you assume that you had a serious shot of breaking the tape, winning the race?
In 1968, I thought that I had a chance of running very, very well. A couple of reasons. I knew I was in very good shape because I had been doing well. And, Jim, 1968 was an Olympic year, and in an Olympic year, some of the best runners skip Boston so they can prepare for the Olympics. I was preparing for the Olympics, but to me, the Boston Marathon was more important than the Olympics because my coach, John J. Kelly, had won it in 1957. So I went to Boston. Not everybody did.
How did you hook up with Johnny Kelly, Amby? What was the connection?
Completely fortuitous. He was just a an English teacher at my high school. I was not in any of his classes, actually, but we got together after school for cross country practice, and he was, you know, he was a not a Renaissance man. He was so far ahead of his time. He was an organic gardener in the 50s. He was an environmentalist. He rode his bicycle to school in the 50s rather than using a car. So he taught us to love the environment, love running, and love the freedom.
One more question about 1968, Amby. So obviously, you know, Boston was a big deal marathon, but as you mentioned, some of the Olympians didn't show up. So, and you were just a kid. I mean, 21 years old at Wesleyan and stuff. Compare it, the what it was like in terms of like how big a deal. It wasn't that big of a deal then in terms of a big time sporting event.
Well, Marjorie, I'll disagree with you a little bit. For those of us who were trying to be among the best runners in the world and who followed the sport and wanted to be a part of it, Boston was in some ways bigger then than now because it was all alone. There were no other big marathons in London, New York City, Los Angeles, the entire globe. So you had to be at Boston. You wanted to be at Boston. It was the place where you established yourself as a runner, and how you ran and performed at Boston meant everything if you were a young budding runner trying to leave your mark on the sport.
So, Amby, you had an experience that I'm thinking is likely that neither Marjorie or I will ever have. You actually broke the tape at the finish line in 1960.
Right.
What is that feeling like when you know you've won the Boston Marathon? What was that like that second?
I've never been successful at describing it. I think it was just too overwhelming. First, I collapsed utterly into Jock Semple's arms. If he had not been there, I would have done a face plant on the sidewalk, I'm sure. And then, you know, there's just this total disbelief that as young as I was, running well at Boston, winning Boston was something that I had thought about, dreamed about many, many nights, and to actually achieve it was just, you know, almost beyond my wildest expectations.
And Amby, I should know this, but I've forgotten. Which was the year where women were first allowed legitimately?
Yeah, it was 1966. Next year, well, the first women ran in 1966. That'll be the 50th anniversary next year.
Okay.
The first official year for women was not until 1972.
Wow. Wow.
We're talking to Ambi Burfoot, won the Boston Marathon in 1968, 50 years of it. He's back running on Monday, which we'll talk about in a minute. Ambi, 2013, I mean, I described at the top of this discussion a little bit what happened. You were less than a mile away from the finish line. Describe the scene to us, what you sensed, what you knew, what you thought was happening.
Yeah, we were all, you know, by the time you're at the 25-mile mark, you pretty much have checked off the box that you're going to finish Boston. You're looking to cruise into the finish line, wave to the fans, and celebrate your own accomplishment to some extent. And then we're suddenly stopped for no apparent reason in the middle of the road. And I say no apparent reason because we were far enough away, there were enough buildings between us and the finish that we heard no sounds, knew nothing about what had gone on at the finish line. So we're standing in the middle of the road and somebody's not letting us finish the Boston Marathon, and we're pretty darn unhappy about that. And we're like cursing and threatening to break through police lines and all of that sort of stuff. And of course, several hours later, we finally get back to hotel rooms and things and realize the gravity of the situation. And then you're kind of shocked at your own selfishness for what you were feeling in the middle of the road. But it was complete chaos, confusion, and then the horror of it.
You know, Ambi, I remember being down there as a reporter covering what happened at the marathon. And I remember being at that point where a lot of the runners were totally freezing because they'd been running at this point 25 miles. They're in their little tiny running outfits. Then they stop. And it was warm, but it wasn't that warm. And just they're being so cold and many of them not having cell phones and having no idea what was going on, and regular bystanders giving them their sweaters and their jackets and their scarves and all that. It was just chaos.
There were so many stories of how the community of Boston, the people who lived downtown, took care of the runners at that point of the day. And I had very, very good friends who were walking to a hotel room in Cambridge, and they were freezing and they were depleted and they didn't have any money, and somebody actually bought them the cab ride to get to Cambridge. But it was just astonishing how the people, everybody turned out to take care of each other. In the worst of all situations, of course, sometimes you get the most wonderful human behavior, and that's what we saw, I think, in the aftermath. And I know that's one of the reasons that I and so many marathoners were so eager to come back last year and run again to thank the citizens of Boston for their support each and every year, and particularly 2013.
And you did run last year. And if I had spoken to you, which I actually did, if I had spoken to you right before you ran last year's race and said, so, Ambi, what are the odds that an American is going to win this important marathon a year after the bombings? What would you have said the odds were?
Well, somewhere between 1 in 10 and 1 in 100, and probably more 1 in 100. And I was at the 8-mile mark of the race yesterday, last year, in the third wave, of course, when the fans started saying, an American won, an American won. And I was like, oh, come on, people, try and get a grasp on your reality. That could not have happened. And to find out that Meb had won and to find out that there are so many reasons for his personal story that make him kind of the perfect winner of the 2014 Boston Marathon, it was just an unbelievable capper to an already terrific day.
So what does it make him the perfect winner? Is it because he wasn't a kid? He wasn't the 21-year-old? He'd been around for a while? What makes him the perfect story last year, Ambi?
For me, anyway, everything from his immigrant status to the fact that he was very, very much an underdog, 1 in 10, 1 in 100. He'd run Boston unsuccessfully in the past. On the morning of the race, he got up and penciled the names of the people who were killed the previous year on four corners of his number. That he comes from a large, hardworking family that never had any thought that there would be a runner in the family, but instilled all the values that all of us try to instill in our families and children. And all of this came together in one runner in one day. It was quite fantastic.
So, Ambi Burfoot, what are you doing on this marathon day?
I'm starting in Hopkinton and hoping to finish in Boston before the rains come. Looking forward to a very nice, modest celebration of My own good life and the good health and all the blessings I've had.
Well, speaking of good health, you know, running marathons obviously takes a toll on your body, and I'm wondering about your injuries. I mean, I saw you on television last night with Jim Browder. You could be in the movies. I mean, you look terrific. You're a very young looking guy, but how are your knees and your shin splints and all that?
Marjorie, nobody's ever said that to me before. You could be in the movie.
You look terrific. I have to say, you look great.
Thank you. I'm very, very lucky. I have no structural problems at all. My knees, my back, all those things that people think will give out in 105,000 miles, which is about how much I've run in
wow.
my lifetime. They're fine. Again, that's partially genetic. It's partially the fact that I've been running consistently for 50 years, so I've built up to what I do now. But, you know, most of us do quite well. All the health statistics on running are very, very good, of course. The one thing we can't stop is slowing down. We all get slower, and you have to learn to live with that.
Yeah. You know, Ambie, I asked you last night about one of your college roommates, who probably most people in the audience have heard of, Bill Rogers. You won in 68. He won for the first time in 75. And I asked you whether when you looked over his bed at your buddy, did you see a future marathon champion? And what did you say?
No, Bill was kind of a lazy party guy back in his college days. I couldn't get him up out of bed on Sunday mornings to do the long runs with me. Sometimes he'd meet me halfway. So I can say that I knew he had talent. He had this wonderful, relaxed personal style, which has stood him very well in his running career. But he didn't have the grit. He didn't have the fire in his belly at that point. He did develop it later, and he was very, very fierce when he did come to it. But I couldn't have predicted it when we were in college.
What happened in his life to transition from that lazy, sweet kid in your room to the fierce competitor that he became that everybody in Boston loves?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim, and I'm not sure any of us have the answer. What we do know, you know, Bill drifted in life and had some knock-around jobs in Boston in the early 70s and was smoking cigarettes. And at some point, he just decided to throw off the bad stuff and get it together. And when he did it with an absolute intensity and focus that was remarkable and yielded incredible results.
You know, Ambie, I think for most people who've been around a little while, they would say that the couple of institutions that caused running to explode like it did was one, Jim Fix's book, obviously the late Jim Fix, and Runner's World magazine, which you've been an intimate part of for decades. Why do you think, was it just that fitness caught on in this country? Why did running go from something for people like you, who are outliers to a great degree, to something that's become so mainstream and so huge in America?
Well, you're absolutely right. It was just the outliers at the beginning, and we felt that everybody else in the world regarded us as you know, weirdos and crazies and people running around from mental institutions in our underwear, because that's what the running stuff looked like. But you know, a lot of stuff happened in the 70s from Earth Day and Frank Shorter and a growing interest in eating a little bit healthier back then. And then we did begin to get some women in the sport in the 70s and Joan Benoit winning the Olympics. But, you know, the biggest change in the sport in the last 50 years is the tremendous number of women who are out running now. More than 40% of the Boston Marathoners, more than 50% of the entire running population. And that really correlates with Oprah Winfrey running a marathon in 1994.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it correlates. I can't say it was the cause, but she ran her marathon in 94, and it was since the mid-90s that the women's running revolution has taken off. And I think the fact that people saw that Oprah, the last person you would expect to be able to do a marathon, it was, if Oprah can do it, so can I. I just got to get my butt out there and start working a little bit.
Well, you know, I remember way back when the thinking was, Ambie, that women couldn't run a marathon. right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, run a marathon, you'll never have a child, no guy will ever want to marry you. It went on and on and on. And, you know, all of that has been proven completely untrue. And now women really excel at running almost because they aren't men. Men, too much testosterone, we tend to think the world is all about fast and now and sprint and power. And of course, in the marathon, it's about nice and steady and consistent, wins the race. And women are really, really good at that.
So, Amber, you're a New Englander and you're talking to, I would say, one person who is open-minded about the Olympics coming to Boston in 2024. And one person, I won't tell you who that person is standing across from me, who is wildly cynical about the whole project. Where are you on an Olympics coming to New England, coming to Boston 9 years from now?
Well, I am open-minded. I understand it's a big struggle, and of course you can't do it without the people behind you, and that's very, very important, and that'll work out through the processes that Boston's in the middle of now. I will say this as someone who's been to probably a dozen Olympics as a media representative. The tough times are always the years leading up to the Olympics, and when and if they do come to a town such as London in 2012. In the last year and or so, everybody tends to get behind things and really become a rallying to show off their city in the best possible light. So I certainly think Boston's got some infrastructure problems that have to be dealt with, but it would be fantastic to see an Olympics in New England.
Last thing for me, Amby Burfoot. You know, Alberto Salazar, and I'm not going to quote him directly, but it's pretty close, great marathon champion of a few decades ago. He was once interviewed after winning the New York City Marathon, and he said something like, the reporter said, God, it's got to be so hard to run like that for 2 hours and 10 minutes. He said, it's hard, but it's not nearly as hard as running like that for 4 hours and 40 minutes, meaning for the people at the back of the pack. So which is harder? You were that guy, and now you're this guy. Which is harder, what you're doing at this year's marathon or what you did in 1968?
Well, I give Alberto credit for saying that, because we should all acknowledge that the people who come in 4.5 hours are working darn hard, don't have Alberto Salazar's talent, probably are not professional runners, and they probably have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do their training and whatnot. I'll say this: what's hard about being an Alberto Salazar or someone trying to win the marathon is much more often than not you don't win because you're facing a world of competitors, and so psychologically it can be very, very distressing when you put everything into training for a year and you don't win the race. Whereas back in the middle of the pack, most of us understand we'd like to run a good time. We probably won't this year because there was too much snow in Boston for us to train. And so we'll be happy to run a little bit slower than usual and just enjoy the whole experience and get to the finish line down at Copley and be very, very pleased that we've done it again.
Amby, good luck on Monday. It's great to talk to you again.
Love talking to you, Amby. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, guys.
Amby Burfoot won the 1968 Boston Marathon, and he's running it again this year. Coming up, Pope Francis is giving U.S. nuns a break. Will Reverend Irene Monroe give the Pope one? All revved up, and our weekly Pope Watch is next on 89.7 WGBH. And by the way, if you want to see the picture of Jim Browdy finishing the New York City Marathon, check out Boss Public Radio or Jim Browdy on Twitter. Did I get that? Boss
you got it
Public
right.
Radio, I got it right. Or Jim Browdy on Twitter. He's got a million pictures all around the studio.
No,
he's driving me crazy. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brella. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day are Reverend Irene Monroe and Reverend Emmett Price. Reverend Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist, and Reverend Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Good to see you both.
Hey, thanks for having us
back.
Great
to be now, here on Marathon Monday.
Exactly. Before we start, Marjorie, I'd like to hold up some exhibits that Irene has brought in today. Now,
exhibits. That's
this
right.
Is she was at the expo for the marathon. What is this a photo of, please?
It is yet another picture of Jim Browdy finishing the New York City marathon.
But now, Irene, statement though.
It says, "I ran a half marathon. Sounds so much better than I quit halfway through a marathon." That's not true. Thank you. Now, what would this be, Marjorie? What would that be a photo of? Thank you.
That's another picture of Jim doing his workout.
Thank you very
and what
much.
Does the
you're
statement
really,
say,
really
though?
Buttering him up.
Now,
I know where this
later.
Is going. I've been listening today.
And what is this one? Go Team Jim and Marjorie. This is actually a picture of me finishing a marathon and a picture of you with me in your bicycle basket as E.T.
How did I know that I would need to take multiple pictures of myself years ago? For this
Before
day.
Before we get
today.
Started, Irene, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You were able to find pictures of me finishing a marathon. Is that correct? Yes or no?
Oh my goodness!
No, it's a yes or no question.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, fine. Now, how many photographs? Because you don't have any here. How many photographs of Marjorie finishing a marathon were you able to secure? How many?
Well, I didn't look hard enough. How
Apparently
about that,
not.
Marjorie?
I don't think I took any pictures.
But I just need to say that there are a lot of unflattering photos of Jim. A tsunami of them.
Fine. Emma, I'd like you, before we get started, I'd like you to read one number on the air, please.
Uh-huh.
Okay? First of all, why don't you read Marjorie's finish? Oh, she doesn't have any with her. Why don't you read, what does that say in that little circle there?
3 hours, 39 minutes, and 56 seconds.
And what name is that right there?
The 1981 Browdy. New York City.
Browdy.
Yeah, Browdy. There's
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. So can I tell you what my New York time was?
No, I don't really care.
Yeah,
you were a track star.
Star.
You were a track star.
I was a track star.
259.03.
Is that really true?
259.03.
But you were a track star. Like, weren't you a
big
track star?
That's right.
You ran like 5 minute miles, correct?
And ran it my sophomore year. At Wellesley.
Did
That's
you
right.
really?
That's right. But that was a three hour, and I think that was 3:25 or something like that. But that was my first
you
one.
You were hurting.
Oh, painfully so. Yeah. Painfully
and by
so.
By the way, and thank you for bringing us goodies from the Marathon Expo.
Oh,
very
thank
kind
the
of.
Expo. So all these minute. Freebies.
Before we move on, so what was the previous time? 2 what?
2:59.
So you were
just a few seconds under 3.
So you were running
absolutely
5 minute miles.
And if
a little
I had
bit
not,
above.
And if I had not blown out my knee, perhaps you would have heard of me.
Wow. Look at her. That is very impressive.
Okay. For starters, though, getting back to the semi-real world, let's listen to Barack Obama expressing some frustration about a particular nomination that, as of the moment, is not going very far. Here's the president.
It's gone too far. Enough. Enough. Call Loretta Lynch for a vote. Get her confirmed. Put her in place. Let her do her job. This is embarrassing. A process like this.
You know, I didn't see that statement. I obviously just heard it along with you. The president never sounds angry, which some people have criticized him for. He actually sounds angry. Your first African-American nominee to be Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, has been held up for week after week after week after week because apparently there's some dispute about a provision that relates to abortion in this sex trafficking bill. So what do you make of this, Emmett Price?
Well, I mean, this is horrible because the holdup has absolutely nothing to do with her. I mean, we're in 5 months in from when she was nominated on November 8th, and she's still not seated yet. And this is absolutely politics, not as usual. It used to be partisan politics, but this is not even partisan politics. This is personal now.
That's right.
I mean, this is, really Mitch McConnell and the Senate essentially holding back the opportunity for this very skilled, this very proven,
flawless
this very trusted person.
They've approved
candidate.
Her before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Two times.
Yeah. But, I've read a lot of accounts, Irene Monroe, that say this is about race. I don't think it's about race at all. I think
it's about Barack Obama. So if it's about Barack Obama, there's that component.
I meant about the race of the nominee.
Oh, no, I really
don't.
I mean,
if it was a white guy, he had nominated for Attorney General.
I don't think it's that. But how it becomes racialized is simply because last month you had about 20 African-American women who went to Capitol Hill to protest the slow walking and stalling of her confirmation outside of Senator McConnell's office. This Wednesday, there will be African-American men who will go to Capitol Hill. It becomes racialized because I really felt like, particularly with the women, I was looking for a sisterhood of many women in support of Loretta Lynn. So that's how it becomes racialized. And
well,
now,
also because it's disrespecting a black woman.
Yeah,
in a way that's taken a new threshold of disrespect.
They said this is a Rosa Parks example.
Yeah, but
she's
this is
been
disrespecting
forced to sit
the
in the
American people. I mean, for you to have somebody who is the existing attorney general to be seated, held hostage.
U.S. attorney.
U.S. attorney, yeah. Excuse me. U.S. attorney held hostage.
For nearly
by the,
6 months.
By the Senate. I mean, that's absurd.
And the interesting thing is, I thought they would move expeditiously on Loretta Lynn, largely
they can't
because
stand Eric Holder.
Right,
exactly.
Right. So I don't quite get, I don't understand the logic point. Behind it. But now hunger strikes are going on, and your boy Who's Al that? Sharpton is orchestrating.
Your high school classmate, yeah.
He's lost so a lot of weight. He better not go on a hunger strike. There's not much left of him.
Absolutely
as it is.
Absolutely right. But I did hear that Harry Reid was going to force a vote because you have sort of like what 46. Democrats that definitely will vote for, and we need about what four or five.
Well, I don't know procedurally. I thought you need 60 to do virtually anything here, but I'm not sure how close it is. In any case, so the Lynch nominee. I think the most important part is the President of the United States is angry.
Yes,
I have to say, and
we've never seen that.
I've been
before.
Looking. Well, yeah. No, I think a lot of people have been looking for it, and I think it's not a bad subject matter. Can we go to another situation? Go ahead, Margaret. I'm sorry.
Yeah, down in North Charleston, South Carolina, everybody knows a terrible story about Walter Scott. He was shot running away multiple times by a white police officer down there. Now there's a second story emerging about the second officer who had nothing to do with the shooting, but he was the first cop to arrive on the scene after the shooting, and he is a black guy, and he's taking a lot of heat because he did not do enough, people are claiming, to try to help Mr. Scott. Was not seen performing CPR. The two guys were just standing kind of around there and not doing enough. What do you make of this, Emmett?
Well, I think the big issue here, we have Officer Habersham, 37-year-old African-American male, as you described. After the account, after the video came, there was an account that he said that he was doing CPR on Mr. Scott, and that he was instrumental in leading the medical workers to the body. And of course, there's no visual signs of that on the video. And so there's a number of issues here. One, did he lie? I'm not sure we have enough information to know that. But two, is there a double standard? Right, because we were quick to throw Officer Slager under the bus to say, you know, and he was accused of murder and indicted and whatnot. And now you have this kind of wishy-washy situation where Habersham has not been indicted, but yet he's getting a lot of ridicule. And so for me, you know, no matter what happened, I'm concerned about him.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why, like I said, the other slogan that needs to go along with Black Lives Matter is how cops respond, largely because it makes us look at this issue in a much broader, from a much broader lens, which is the culture of policing in America. And interestingly enough, not enough information is really done, well, I should say investigation done in terms of the pressure that cops of color have to endure being in predominantly white forces, because a lot of times they'll go along to just get along.
Yeah.
So they will be equally as problematic as white officers. And the interesting thing is that places like Boston, particularly when we look at towns like Chelsea and Roxbury, we still have a sort of predominantly white police force. A place that we don't have one, believe it or not, People's Republic of Cambridge. We have the most diverse police force really in the state. Some have said even in the country. But interestingly enough, you have the same sort of problems around implicit bias, because we had the not only Skip Gate case, but we've had many other cases like Skip Gate, where blacks are over-policed, or not just in Area 4, but in other parts of Cambridge.
Well, by the way, we can get back to Boston in a second, because I think that Evans, based on the data that I've seen, has done more to promote people of color in the top his command staff than clearly than anybody before him. But the Minority Police Officers Association surely doesn't agree. I think this situation with Habersham, based on how I read, is disgusting. If this guy were a white guy, if this were white cop,
no question about that.
I don't know if he'd be indicted, but there should be unanimity of condemnation by organizations of black Americans, half of whom are saying the evidence isn't – well, they're saying the evidence isn't in on Slager. I mean, the video shows, as you say, Emmett, is in total contradiction to what he says doing CPR. It doesn't prove, as some are suggesting, that he just stood there while people think that Slager planted that taser,
because
no one is 100% sure it was a taser, even though it looks like it. But it shows that he was lying about the most critical part of this.
Though,
why aren't people from Sharpton on down saying, we want this guy guy indicted just like Slager?
It should have started with Eric Gardner, if you recall, because after he was down, a black
that
female
is correct.
Police
that
officer,
is correct.
And nobody said anything. So there's a certain kind of silence around this issue, and I don't know how much of it is because the constraints that they feel under or basically the way in which we just spin this story.
It's an unhealthy double standard.
All right. Well, I think there's also, as you mentioned before, Irene, this big, you know, culture of shut up about your fellow officers. What do they call it? The thin blue line, or whatever it is. I mean, coming back to movies that I saw when I was a little kid, like Serpico, about, you know, nothing to do with race. It had about somebody telling on some nefarious deeds going on in the police department. So you get this sense in a lot of these situations, black, white, no matter what you are, shut up about your fellow officers, and that's not a healthy situation.
And that's, and interestingly enough, that can be in any workplace, pretty much.
Yeah,
it's about being part of the team.
By the way, I have to make a correction. I criticized, because this is part of what I do, Al Sharpton. I'm not a fan of his at all. Actually, Sharpton is amongst those African-American leaders who are criticizing the actions of Officer Habersham, along with the National Bar Association, mostly an African-American legal group. But on the flip side, and so my apologies to Reverend Al there, here's Charles Wilson, chair of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers. He is on the campus police force at Rhode Island College in Providence. He says it is way too early to make any judgments about Officer Habersham's conduct. No, it's not. There's no evidence that corroborates the public statements Habersham has made.
Yes,
you know what's most troubling? I know this is not an original thought. You say to yourself, Habersham lied.
Mm-hmm.
Slager lied.
Yeah.
If it turns – I mean, a total lies on both their parts. Video is everything.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question we would never have heard of Walter Scott. We would never be looking into this. There'd be complete either complicity or – agreement or cover. It is so, if it doesn't open the minds of Americans around this country about all of the cases where there isn't video, and again, I know it's been said 1,000 times in the last month, then you're fooling yourself.
Yeah, and then it becomes complex. It's very complex because even as we're talking about this particular incident, a new incident just recently happened with Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old who died just yesterday. He was arrested by a police officer in Baltimore who broke his spine in several places, and he died due to his injuries and stuff. So, you know, there's always the over-policing, and we say, well, we want more cops on the force. And my point is that I don't care how many cops of color we get. If you don't change the culture, you're not changing anything.
Well, let's get back to Boston, because Jim did mention before, and you guys mentioning it, Irene was anyway, that there was this Roxbury Forum and Community Policing, and the guy that runs the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers blasted Bill Evans, the commissioner of police in Boston, for saying there are not enough men and women of color on the police force. That's President Larry Ellison. When we had Evans in here last week, he was talking about one of the difficulties is veterans' preference deal, and that
under the civil service, right?
Yes, and that because I was surprised at this, because there's an awful lot of black guys and women that serve in the armed forces, but apparently a lot of these veterans were white, mm-hmm. which meant they got preference because they were veterans. That had been one of the problems. But he has promoted people into leadership positions. So it seems to me he has done a pretty good job so far. What do you think, Emmett?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a fan of the commissioner. And I also know Larry very well, and I'm actually a fan of the work that he's doing as well. What the commissioner has done in a very quick amount of time has made progress.
Yeah.
He's gone to 3 captains of color where there were previously none.
Yeah.
That's right.
But progress does not mean that we've reached the goal. And so I think that we do need to give him credit for having the courage to change the tide and to actually make
and the culture
and be very consistent about his approach to doing it. But the conversation needs to continue, right? Because 3 in the higher ranks is not enough when you have a gap in the middle.
Yeah,
right?
But Ellison, Ellison, head of the Minority Association, the Mass Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, is not just saying, Emmett Price, that we've made some progress and more needs to be made. Quote, and this is the Boston Herald, we still have a lot of the same obstructions from the Davis, meaning Ed Davis administration, to the current administration. And that simply is, I mean, what you say is, I think, a fair statement. What Ellison seems to be saying is not a reflection of the changing reality in the first year and a few months of Evans and Walsh, is it or is it?
Well, no, I'm not going to defend, Larry's agenda. I think Larry clearly has an agenda. And I think
in the macro,
it's a good one. In the micro, I think it may be a little, hyper-political. And these guys, meaning Larry and the commissioner, know each other for many, many decades. I mean, they've worked closely hand in hand. And so there's some, internal stuff there. I think, there's a number that they recruited 2,000 applicants and 53% of those applicants were of color. I think that's great. The question is, how do you deal with the veterans? How do you deal with some of these other systematic, mechanisms that are in place?
So that's why I think that's why Larry, even if his agenda is political, it needs to be to sort of keep his foot on the pedal on this issue. I mean, you got to understand that this was a police force that has always been predominantly white. And so even though we have three blacks in key positions and a few others here and there and it's becoming more diverse, you really do need people in key positions to really change this kind of culture.
I think it's the first part of a sentence should be, yes, there has been progress in the whatever it is, 14 months or whatever that Evans has been here. However, as Emmett put it, this is simply not enough. Okay. You got to do a lot more. I don't know how you say Evans and Ellison have had a long relationship. I'm sure they have because they've both been around a long time. But if you want to work with somebody and they do something good, I don't care what the forum
I'd
is.
Agree.
Okay. You got them a little bit of credit for the good before you focus on the not good enough.
I agree. But the very interesting thing, and I'm sort of a little fatigued by this, is that every time a cop does something that he should be doing, we applaud them. And I just think that that's ridiculous. You're doing the right thing. You should be doing the right thing.
Yeah, but they haven't done it for ages here. And so it's not just the typical thing. It's an aberrational good thing, is I guess what I'm saying. In any case, okay. Here is a little musical quiz for the two of you, because I think actually I want to get you in a better mindset on Marathon okay. and Patriots okay. Day. We want you to listen to the song.
Okay.
And then as soon as you hear it, whoever knows why we're playing it has to raise their hand and they will be recognized. You ready, Emmett Price? No, don't raise your hand yet, Irene. Here is the song. Go ahead.
Not be silenced. It never has. It never will. Let justice roll like a river.
No hands are up yet.
From the oceans to the hills.
Oh,
well,
my
okay,
goodness.
Irene, we don't want you to sing it. We just want to. It is called Love Cannot Be Silenced. Why are we playing that either Irene or Emmett? Does anybody know?
Because my love is passionate.
Well, maybe it is, but that would be wrong. Well, it may be right, but that isn't the answer. That is, we don't know her name, but she is a folk singing sister in Chicago. She is singing, of course, that great song she wrote, Love Cannot Be Silenced.
I don't know if I go that far.
It is in
great song?
It is in support of a
really,
leadership conference of women religious. And why would she be singing? What's the relevance of that? Because the Pope, as I think you probably know, some think in anticipation of his visit to the U.S., as the headline in the New York Times says, ends battle with U.S. Catholic nuns group. By the way, a group
finally.
That represents roughly 80%
yeah.
of the nuns in the United States. Well, we won't start with you, Irene.
Well, it's an amen moment.
Amen.
It
what
really
would you
is.
Say? First of all, rate the song. You know a little bit about music, we're
oh,
told.
Oh, my goodness.
And two, a comment on the Pope's
oh,
behavior,
that
please.
Song is a zero. We just really need to – I couldn't even get my groove on that one.
You on that
really?
One,
the power of the song is in the lyric. The lyric is powerful. So let's give it a 3.5.
Thank you.
And I think this is a historic moment again
oh,
because
and we do need
can
to
he
just
finish his sentence, please? Go ahead.
Glass half
go ahead.
Full kind of guy.
Go ahead.
Go
what
ahead,
is it?
It shows
no glass.
It shows that the current Pope is not held hostage to some of Benedict XVI's antics.
Benedict was upset because they weren't spending enough time, these nuns,
that's
on things
right.
like abortion and gay marriage. They were focusing on poor people. They actually had some speakers who didn't agree with church doctrine. And now, essentially, this current Pope is saying, pull back, let them do their work.
Let them be. Let
okay.
them be.
So what do you, Irene, you're not going to give him credit for this either?
Oh, no, I give him a little bit of credit. Okay. I mean, considering that the Catholic Church either likes our nuns to be flying nuns or singing nuns. So, I mean, considering that
nuns.
They can be working nuns and be compensated for it, not in terms of, monetarily, but in terms of, congratulations or praise from the Pope, it says a lot of things because they run the churches, they run the schools, they run the hospitals, they run the charities. It's a dying institution, so he really fully understands, particularly in the United States, that if he doesn't do something on this issue, we will continue to lose them, because the only countries that where nuns are really growing in number is Asia and Africa.
Africa, yeah.
You know, and one of the reasons why the nuns are leaving. I mean, when the average age is 65, come on now.
Is that the average age of American nuns?
That's the average.
65?
That's right. And those old nuns are still working. Yeah. Are still working until they drop.
They got to pay the bills.
Absolutely. And younger women who have an interest in religious life said the reason, one of the reasons they won't do it is because of that song we just heard.
Well, no, speaking of that song, can we please hear, as we bid you,
the nuns that are
can
young,
we please hear Love Cannot Be Silenced in the background as Irene?
The young nuns that are joining are ultra-conservatives.
That's right. They absolutely.
Now, Irene, before you go, I know you wanted to read this. Could you
do
me a favor? What is this name right there?
It says Browdy.
Okay, don't go away. And what is that? What is that time right there?
Oh, you really?
What time does that say?
That is 3:39:50.
Thank you very
right
much.
There.
Thank you very much.
I beat him. I want
now,
him to know,
I'm
but
impressed.
He doesn't believe
before
me.
Before you go, could you read Marjorie's time from the Lake Champlain race?
I don't have mine.
You don't have yours. Okay,
that's
fine.
I came in third, though, Irene.
Okay, fine.
I'm not nearly as fast as you, though.
By the way, I forgot to tell you, you came in third. I won the Olympics in 1994, wherever it was. I forgot to tell you that.
Okay.
Emmett, it's great to see you, Irene. Thanks for the gifts and the photos and the swag.
Let's go out and run now.
You
come
are
on now.
Maybe a little later.
Look at these guys in the pouring rain. They're inspired. They're out there and they're running out.
Great to see you both. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. The Reverend Irene Monroe, is a syndicated religious columnist. She's a glass-half-empty kind of gal. Reverend Emmett Price, Mr. Glass-half-full, professor of music at Northeastern University. But Irene did bring us presents. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thank you guys both for coming in. Up next, our TV expert, Bob Thompson, joins us for his best and worst moments of television this week. That and more with Bob Thompson next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I loathe Lucy. That's what folks in upstate New York are saying about what has been dubbed the Scary Lucy statue. It's a bronze sculpture of Lucille Ball that resembles not so much the zany redhead, but a zombie. Looks like the sculptor behind the statue has some splaining to do. Join us on the line. Thank you very much, Marjorie. Join us on the line to talk about this and other news from the TV universe is Bob Thompson. Bob is the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Easy for me to say, hey, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, let's start with this Lucy controversy, Bob. I'm not clear why anybody would make a statue, as the piece points out, with a deranged grimace and jagged teeth and this weird hairdo that looks like it's a man's hairdo. It's not even a woman's hairdo. So what's the story?
Well, certainly great artists and great sculptors have not been afraid to make art that looks deranged and that has grimaces. We could talk about them all day. But it's one thing to make for Balzac to be sculpted. It's another thing for Lucille Ball to be the subject of a sculptor. She's beloved. It's in the title itself. And I have to say, anybody that goes on and looks at a picture of that, it's from her Vitamin Meta Vegemin episode. It is a pretty scary looking thing. So now there's been this whole petitions being signed, and the first sculptor said he'd fix it, and now there's maybe a new sculptor coming in. And I swear, America has not paid so much attention to a piece of sculpture in a long time.
Well, also, it doesn't even look like her. That's the other thing. I mean, it really, you'd never guess unless someone told you this is supposed to be Lucille Ball. So I find that a little bit problematic, unless you're like doing Picasso or something with a cubist rendition, but there's nothing cubist about this either.
So, Bob,
it's something, but it's not cubist.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people think the greatest comedian of all time. I would argue the best female comic on TV or comedic actress, for lack of a better expression, is Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I watched, I think it was the first episode of this season of Veep. It is really one of the funniest half hours in television I have seen in years. Are you on the same page as I am or no?
Yeah, well, and not only am I on the same page, a lot of other people are as well. She keeps getting nominations and awards, and the Emmys love her, and she's getting a lot of attention. May actually be the first person that her work after Seinfeld is better than her work in Seinfeld.
That is a great point. By the way, if you've missed Veep, it's on HBO. This is a scene from season four. It features, as we said, Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Selina Meyer. Here is Meyer talking to subordinate Gary Walsh, who's played by Tony Hale. Please listen.
Gary?
Yeah.
Do you have my hand cream?
Oh, yeah. I got the new formula from La Prairie.
No, just give me the whole tube, because you can't come into this next meeting either.
And I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah. Oh, hey, Gary?
Yeah.
What is the coffee that the Navy stewards use?
Oh, I can only imagine.
It's heaven.
Oh.
It's like Colombian tongue sex.
Wow.
Why don't we ever use that coffee?
I don't know, but you love our old coffee.
Yeah. No.
And by the way, if you haven't been following it, this is not giving anything away. The Veep is at least an interim president and is running for the top job. She is really something else.
And her whole,
else.
The surrounding cast.
Is brilliant.
If the whole show is a riot.
Yeah, that particular scene with Gary is one of the most beautiful love stories where nobody ever kisses or touches.
that's beautifully put. And she's speaking of Seinfeld, which you mentioned a minute ago, probably the most successful post-Seinfeldian actor, including arguably Seinfeld himself. She's doing a thing with this Comedians in Cars thing, which we've talked to you about on, what is it, the Crackle Network, wherever that is?
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, Crackle's been doing a lot of exciting stuff for quite some time, including Comedians in Cars having coffee. And I'm kind of surprised that she hasn't done one. When they announced that she was doing it, it was like, oh, yeah, I guess she hasn't. But he's done it with the other co-stars so far. And we've talked about Comedians in Cars having coffee a couple of times. The fun, short little bursts that Seinfeld does, because Seinfeld now can do whatever Seinfeld feels like doing.
Why is Seinfeld, I'm so glad you put it that way. Is he not doing more and is not in prime time because he chooses not to be, or what is it? I mean, his stuff has gotten good.
Yes, I think he was not in prime time. I mean, when Seinfeld ended, that was Seinfeld's choice. It was not like NBC said, you're canceled, you're off the air. They were on the top of their game. And yes, I think he would have any number of projects he could choose from. I think he's doing pretty much what he wants to do, because he reached that point in his career. You know, once you've done Seinfeld, at that point you have to just sort of do what you want, because it's going to be really hard to top something like that. And as he's pointed out now in some incomprehensible comments he made, he talks about how he was really at the tail end of the network era, which is now over. He's right about that. And then he goes on to say a bunch of stuff that makes no sense.
Well, you know, I've mentioned this to you before when we've discussed Seinfeld, but particularly in light of you having mentioned going out on the top, I'll mention it again. If anybody Googles Larry King's 10 greatest moments, one of the top 10, maybe three or four, him turning to Seinfeld totally seriously in an interview and saying, so, Jerry, how did it feel to be canceled? And Seinfeld, and not mock anger, but total anger and just stunned confusion, says, canceled. Cancel. Larry, we were number one when we – I mean, it is a great Larry King confusion moment.
Does somebody have the top 10?
Like, this must be the third Monday of the month, because every third Monday you bring that up again.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, Bob, does somebody have Larry King's top 10 greatest moments?
Oh, yes. You
That's
Google.
Good.
Well, let me tell you.
There are so many others.
But I'm going to turn you on to something new, Bob, but you probably have it. If you are not following Larry King on Twitter, I would do it like fast. It is the most unbelievable. I'm not going to say why. People can follow. We can discuss next week. One of the truly great tweets, series of tweets, comes from the great Larry King.
Okay.
In any case.
So David Letterman, he's down to the almost the end of his show. When is he ending, Bob Thompson? Is it late in May?
I think it's May 20th is the final.
Yeah, May 20th. And you know, I think of him as a huge genius, too. I mean, I can't believe he's 68 years old. I can't believe – I read this morning he's been on longer than anybody else in terms of continual talk shows, and he's got a star-studded cast.
Yeah, people forget he did a daytime talk show, believe it or not, in 1980 – that didn't work out and that totally mystified his audience. But so he started out more as a Regis type.
You know, we were wondering, we will look down the list. We believe, and you can correct us if wrong, Margie and I are the only two on-air personalities in America who are not guests on the final month. Is that correct?
He's got, yeah.
Wait, you guys aren't? I thought you were on that list.
No.
Yeah, we're a little offended.
Tragically, we did not make the cut.
He's got everybody from Oprah to George Clooney to
Mumford
Tom
and
Hanks.
Sons, Dave Matthews.
He's got absolutely everybody. And then he goes away. What does he do? Does he do specials or what does he do?
I think he pulls a Johnny Carson.
You really think so?
He disappears and nobody hears a word from him. And Carson would have, every now and again, would come and do a talk show. But Letterman is, from all indications, really kind of a misanthrope. And my guess is, when Carson retired, by gosh, he retired.
He did.
And I think Letterman is probably going to do the same thing.
You know, I really hope so. I mean, sometimes you just do want stars to go out and go. Johnny Carson was a fascinating person. I remember a million years ago reading Kenneth Tynan's piece about Carson and the way he lived his life. And he just that was it. He was done. He was gone. And I kind of hope Letterman does that too, because sometimes the second act after all these years is just not what you want.
Well, you know, that is true, and I think it's hard for people to do that. Regis retired, but he keeps popping up, and Larry King, for that matter, we've already talked about. But Johnny Carson was one of those people that really did sort of disappear. And we always have to remember, as tired as Letterman's show is, and wow, when you turn that on these days, it is almost painful to watch.
It is.
It's like watching a loved one in their deep decline. But every single person now on Late Night owes an incredible debt to David Letterman. The only one who didn't was Jay Leno, and now he's, of course, just doing his little car thing and everything.
Wait a minute.
Letterman totally changed Late Night in ways that were profoundly significant.
In deep decline because he's not putting his heart and soul into it anymore because he's just getting older?
Well, I mean, you know, he's been doing this since 1982 on Late Night. Earlier since then, I think he's just tired. You go back and look at some of that stuff he was doing in, the early, especially his NBC work. But, of course, that's the work of a young man. This happens to all of us.
You know, I don't know if you mentioned Larry King. Have I ever told you about Larry King interviewing Seinfeld, Bob? Maybe I have. I can't remember. So how long do we have to wait nervously? Because all three of us are nervous about how Colbert is going to do. He's not there till the fall, correct?
That's right. So, and I'm sure they're doing run-throughs and trust falls and emotional retreats. I mean, I've got a feeling they are really trying to cover that, because I don't think you and I are the only ones worried that transition may be a difficult one for him. And the competition now, I mean, there's so many of these new pressure. It's not like they're competing against just the old guard anymore. We've got a bunch of new late night talent out there.
Well, also, you know, I mean, people say he's not the greatest interviewer in the world, and he's not. But
who?
Kimmel. Not Kimmel. Who's the guy, the other guy that
Jimmy
reminds
Fallon?
Me of
Colbert.
Jimmy Fallon. No, Jimmy Fallon.
But when
you see him, you turn on YouTube and there he is dancing with Michelle Obama. I mean, just to sit there at the end of the day and have some good laughs. I mean, those bits that he does, they're just a riot most of the time. They're wildly successful.
Now, speaking of
Fallon, of course, appeals to the biggest mainstream audience. Kimmel, I think, probably is now appealing to the hip, more college-oriented audience. But Colbert and Corden and all these new people and Trevor Noah are going to want to figure out where they fit into that ever smaller piece of pie environment.
Well, some people say Trevor Noah is appealing to the anti-Semitic audience, but that's
Let's be clear.
So, Baz Luhrmann, I have to say, there's this huge celebration because Baz Luhrmann is bringing a show to Netflix, some show about growing up in New York City in the 70s. What I know from Baz Luhrmann is the worst Great Gatsby, speaking of growing up in the 20s, the worst Great Gatsby, arguably, ever. Why is it such a big deal? Just because yet another film director is moving to television or Netflix, whatever Netflix is. Is that why everybody's raving about this thing in advance?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, the idea that that direct internet programming are now getting these really not only big name directors but kind of art house directors. Baz Luhrmann also did Romeo plus Juliet, hip modern setting Romeo and Juliet thing. He did Moulin Rouge, Strictly Ballroom. And Gatsby, I would recommend going and taking another look at that. I couldn't believe when that came out in 3D. How does F. Scott Fitzgerald need to have 3D? But then when I watched it, it blew me away in that what The Great Gatsby is all about is conspicuous, irresponsible consumption. Yeah. And what better way to show that than in 3D?
Yeah, I didn't think it was as bad as everybody said it was either. I mean, it's so hard because it's such a great book and everybody's read it in school and it's hard to reproduce.
And it's so short, you can read it in a weekend.
I know. I think it's like 150 pages. It's wonderful. All novels should
it's
be 150
pages. Great for high school
pages.
Students. But getting back to Luhrmann's Netflix thing, this sounds actually really interesting. And it's been cast, so I think it's going to happen. It's called, I believe it's called The Get Down. And as you point out, it's growing up in the 70s as disco and hip-hop and rap and all this stuff. I mean, that was a very, very fertile period in music. And at the same time, as you recall, New York was in, talk about steep decline. Getting from Broadway to Grand Central Station took you through some very interesting environments that are now, of course, filled with M&M stores and Disney characters.
Yeah, it is incredible how New York has changed. And Netflix also is renewing for the fourth season. Orange is the New Black. I was confused.
Hasn't even started the third season,
yeah,
has it?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
It's like 3 months from the third season.
Right. So what's that about? That's just part of our we're taking over the world strategy? Or why do they announce this now?
Yeah, well, you're rightly confused. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, usually you see how a show does in a season, and then if it's doing really well, you renew it early. Otherwise, you wait a little bit. Now, oftentimes, these things, there have been shows renewed for second seasons before the very first episode is played. Now we're 3 months before third season of Orange is the New Black. We've already renewed it to the fourth. I think it's a way probably to try to keep these shows in people's consciousnesses because they come out in these big bursts. Everybody talks about them for 2 weeks. Then they've all watched them, and then you've got this long period to wait. So you have to figure out some way to keep people's minds aware of the fact that the show still exists. So you wait a couple of months and you announce its renewal.
You know, speaking,
I wouldn't be surprised if we hear the announcement of the seventh season renewal of House of Cards pretty soon, and it's only in its fourth.
You know, let me ask you a dumb question, Bob. Why do they do it this way? Why not just have everybody wait, like week to week, like you do with Mad Men or something? Why throw them all out there?
Well, I think part of it is imitation of Netflix when they started doing that way, and they got a lot of attention for it. A lot of people ended up checking out House of Cards that wouldn't if they hadn't read those kinds of stories. Secondly, I think it's the way of top-loading binge viewing. For these kinds of serialized programming, we've talked about this before, binge viewing is the most fun way to watch it. So as opposed to making people, you know, doing them once a week and then allowing them to binge view at the end, they figure, why don't we just make them all and allow them to binge view or view once a week or do whatever that it is they feel like it. The reason we haven't seen this before is that online allows this because you simply have inventory.
Yeah.
And people watch that inventory as they please. How would, if NBC decided to do one of these Netflix series dumps, how would they do it? I mean, would they show them all Sunday night until Monday morning? Would they just keep repeating them? I mean, they're a linear, time-based sort of operation, whereas Netflix or Amazon, these places, they can release the stuff however they want.
You know, you reminded me, I have a quiz for you, my weekly quiz for Bob Thompson. You know that Anthony Bourdain is probably my favorite show on television, and I'm watching a whole series of them this weekend. And guess what is the single most popular television show, at least according to this guy he interviewed, in China, Bob? Series.
I'm going to guess, given your introduction, Anthony Bourdain's show.
No, House of Cards. And the guy,
really?
The guy said, and I'm saying why? And the guy said his analysis, which is interesting. We can't criticize our leaders here. So not only do they love the intrigue, but the fact that you see the president and being trashed and the vice president for a short period of time makes it wildly popular. In any case.
I also would love to see Spacey dubbed in Mandarin.
Oh, God. Can you imagine?
That is a great point. Okay, it is that time, as it is every week. Let's start with the worst so we can go out with a bang. What's the worst of the week, Bob Thompson?
All right. Well, don't get me wrong. I'm so happy that television can now actually use the full template, the full palette of the American language, and I think it was ridiculous for how many years you couldn't even say a damn or a hell. But even when I'm watching some of these wonderful shows like Silicon Valley and Veep, I'm beginning to wonder if, in fact, we didn't take that new liberty of language and take it a little too far. Don't get me wrong, I am no member of the Parents Television Council, but sometimes I feel like an old grandmother saying, why do they have to swear so much?
Well, to get us in the mood, here's a scene where swearing is used arguably effectively. It's from the great Breaking Bad. Here's Walter White at his second job working at the car wash. He's staring off into space when his boss tells him to get to work and, quote, go wipe down some things.
Come on, man, I'm shorthanded. I need you outside to do some wipe downs. Come on.
What?
I said I need you outside to do some wipe downs. Are you here to work or to be staring at the skies? Come on, let's go. Come on, man.
F*** you, Bogdan.
I said f*** you and your eyebrows. Wipe down this.
Oh, my God. Do I love that? You know, not only, and it's so rare that I disagree with you, Bob, but I'm actually usually too intimidated to disagree with you. But the reason, Margie and I have been having this debate long before we knew you. My sense is that most cable television that has endless swearing reflects the way most of us talk. And the absurd distinction that broadcast television you can't say, which can say if you just hit another number on your clicker, seems to be so arbitrary and so phony to me. This is the way people talk, no? Or you obviously think it's excessive.
Yes, no, I agree with all of that. I'll never forget a Vietnam-era show came out called Tour of Duty in 87. And this was essentially, it was kind of based on Platoon or ripped off of Platoon. Mm-hmm. And here you're talking about men in battle. I mean, clearly you're going to have a lot of language that isn't exactly choir boy. And there's this episode, and these horrible things happen, and they witness this awful stuff. And one of the soldiers finally breaks down, and he screams at his commanding officer, and at the peak of his anger, he calls him dumb and ugly. It completely insulted that experience by reducing it to that standards and practices accepted language. When you watch Platoon, I have to say they said a little more than dumb and ugly. And then when we opened that up, you can't tell a great story about New Jersey mobsters without using that language. Deadwood, which showed that the West was filled with people who only ended up there because they couldn't handle the civilization where language like that wasn't accepted. There's been great moments of this kind of language. But sometimes I think a lot of it is just getting a little lazy now. Let's remember with that Breaking Bad clip, that is so effective because Walter White very seldom used that language. And when he did, you paid attention.
It's just like
if your dad never cries and all of a sudden a tear comes out of his eye, suddenly, you know, that's much more important than your sister who's crying every 5 minutes.
Well, that's exactly the point. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with a well-placed F-bomb on HBO, but when it's over and over and over again, then it loses its whole effectiveness, the same way it would if you wrote it. You have to be sparing in that, even if it's not the way exactly people will talk.
Well, let me interrupt.
Because then it's just nonstop. It just kind of blends into the woodwork.
Let me just challenge both of you and say a series that all three of us were raving about 15 minutes ago, Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Veep and as president is dropping F-bombs every couple of minutes, no?
Well, you know, that's what prompted me to bring this as a worst this week, because as much as I admire Veep, and I do, I think it's a wonderful show, but it is one of the examples of a program that I think does it in a little more lazy of a way. The way Deadwood did it, the way Sopranos generally use that language, certainly the way Breaking Bad did, was it had an economy to it that I think Veep, it just does it because, let's face it, it's funny. It's just like saying poo-poo or pee-pee to a kid. You always get a laugh.
It is.
And then you were talking about the arbitrary distinctions. I remember back when network television was the only game in town. And those shows in the 80s started wanting to be more sophisticated. And St. Elsewhere was the one that pulled this most of all. It would manage to slip in totally forbidden language, but they do it in a disguised way. One line that the doctors are going down the hallway and they say, oh, such and such in room one, is she okay? No, she's got a cute vagina. And the other doctor says, oh, good thing, because she's got ugly legs. That had to be slipped in there. There was a character named Constance Lingus. I'll leave your listeners ISAT verbal scores to figure out what a dirty joke that was. But it had to be slipped in because, of course, standards and practices wouldn't allow it. I kind of miss some of those days.
Yeah, I think too much it ruins it. I'm with you on that one, Bob Thompson. But anyway, what's your best of the week?
Well, this is kind of an obscure one, but yesterday marked the 30th anniversary of the final broadcast of one of the most extraordinary television achievements of all time, and that was the BBC's production of all 37 of Shakespeare's plays. It was actually 38, but they did 37. It went from 1978 to 85. On April 19th, the last of those, Titus Andronicus, played on PBS here in this country. And to this day, there's five or six Shakespeare plays that the only productions on DVD that you can see are part of that BBC series. It was like the building of the pyramids, an extraordinary achievement.
You know, let my nerd flag fly here and say, I think this would be wonderful to do again.
So do I.
I mean, how many people have said, you know, I want to sit down and read all the Shakespeare plays and all the Shakespeare sonnets, and of course they never do. But this could be, anybody think about just rerunning them, replaying them?
Well, we had a little bit of a start 2 years ago, and I think it played a year ago in this country, they redid the extraordinary tetralogy. And of course, Shakespeare was doing those kinds of sequels. And the one of Richard II, Henry IV, Part 1, Henry IV, Part 2, and Henry V, they had a big, fancy new BBC production under the title The Hollow Crown. It's now available on DVD. So technically, they could still move along there. But to do the whole canon is a really enormous operation, and it wasn't nearly as successful as they hoped, even though they got some standard, you know, Derek Jacobi played Hamlet. Okay, of course he did. But they also got people like John Cleese to play Petruchio in Taming the Shrew. Roger Daltrey plays the twins in Comedy
of Errors.
They did some clever, almost Dancing with the Stars kind of casting.
Oh, well. I guess we just have to get it on DVD.
I'm with Marjorie. Bring it
back.
Yeah,
me too. I would love it. Bob Thompson.
Bob, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bob Thompson joins us every Monday. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Something we just spoke about with Bob Thompson. What about swearing? Bob Thompson thinks there is an excess of it on cable TV. Do you think there's an excess of swearing on TV and in everyday life? We're going to debate that next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Before we get to the topic at hand, if you've just tuned in, the winner of the women's marathon race was Caroline Rotish from Kenya, 2:24:55. The winner of the men's race was Lalisa Desisa from Ethiopia, 2:09:17. Top female finisher from the U.S. was Desiree Linden. Top male finisher from the U.S. was Dathan Ritzenhine, and Meb Kafleski, who won last year's race, came in.
Well, you know what?
Ace. What's
not
up?
Not to be, you know, so rah-rah American, but I'm happy to see that Desiree Linden, she finished fourth.
Yeah, I know.
That's pretty good,
good.
For a American, because we don't usually do that well. And of course, the first American on the men's side was seventh. So There you go.
In any case, as Marjorie teased a couple of minutes ago, we were just talking to Bob Thompson about swearing, and we were talking about it in the context of cable TV, where he thinks, not in all cases, but as a general proposition, there is swearing to excess. And our question to you is not about television, it's about the real world. Do we use swearing too much in our everyday lives? If you stop and think, what drives you to swear? Failure to find the right word, anger, or are there times when it is the only right word? Our number is 877-301-8970. Let me get the part out of the way that I know you're going to say, or someone's going to say. A succession of F-bombs in front of a child is probably not a particularly good thing. I will acknowledge it. I swear much more than you do in private life, and I am aware that obviously one can stop because, to my knowledge, in the 16 or 17 years we've been on the radio, I've only sworn on radio
whatever
once, and the two times I did it on television, I didn't know that I was on, my mic was on when I did it. So I have not done, but listen to this research. This
Jim, hold on. Before you move that off, the parents swearing in front of kids, you have to admit, one of the funniest things ever is when you go to the supermarket or you're at a family event and all of a sudden some kid who's like 2 feet tall drops an F-bomb or says, S beginning with S, you know what word it is or something like that. And this little tiny kid says it, of course. Where did they hear it? Mom and Dad.
Well, I'm going to
back at the ranch.
That's exactly where I was going. There's something called the Association for Psychological Science. And there was a paper done by two members of that called The Science of Swearing. Listen to this, which I guess is not surprising, but maybe it is. The data show that swearing emerges by age 2 and becomes adult-like by 11 or 12. By the time children enter school, meaning kindergarten, they have a working vocabulary of 30 to 40 offensive words. And let me just say, in California, they try what they call a cuss-free week. I agree that there's probably too much of it in the hearing of kids. And I agree that often it's a substitute for a word that fits better. It's just an easy, sloppy language solution. But this angst that people like you and others go through about how much we swear in America in 2015, it's essentially the exclamation mark that people put on sentences. If you say it in anger at somebody.
Yeah, but you know what the problem is? A lot of swears are really ugly words. And it just sort of coarsens.
Oh, there's some. I would agree.
So it's kind of. I mean, I should talk because I've swear a lot. And you felt like if you're a woman, you know, when everything used to be all male dominated, you sort of had to swear to be, you know, tough like the boys and stuff like that. But that's my reassessment of swearing, even though I still do swear too much. Is that it's
were you upset
it's,
when
it's lazy
Joe Biden
and it's coarse.
Was whispering into the ear of the President of the United States when they announced the Affordable Care Act was law? And he said, not knowing that the mic would pick it up is a big effing deal.
Listen, I don't get mad when anybody swears, unless it's one of those really awful words that you don't want to hear.
How about when Dick Cheney told Senator Leahy from Vermont to you-know-what himself because Leahy criticized Halliburton's contracts in Iraq?
No, I wasn't upset, and I'm not upset when
that
you swear.
That was on the floor of the Senate.
Well, okay, I'm sure there have been a few swears spoken in the White House when we get all the White House tapes. I'm sure there's some swearing going on there, too. So I'm not.
So what's your problem with it again?
My problem is that it's become there's
too
just
much
a coarseness. It's too much the norm, and most of the words are ugly, and most of the time people aren't swearing in any kind of clever way. It's just kind of become the default exclamation point.
It is.
You know what I mean?
I agree with it.
Oh, it's blankety blank raining outside. That seems a little, you know.
That's a good point.
Your hair looks blankety blank. Great.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a good point.
It's a little much,
that's
don't you think?
877-301-8970. Again, Bob Thompson says too much swearing, at least on some cable television shows. I think I'm going to summarize his position if you didn't hear him a few minutes ago. If it fits the situation, like when you're dealing with mobsters in New Jersey, like on The Sopranos, it fits. But again, I guess my concern is all the hand wringing that goes on about how much swearing there is.
Okay, do you want it to be on? Do you want? We can't swear on regular television.
Yes.
Or you can't swear on the radio. You can't say certain words on the radio.
I think it's ridiculous.
So you think we should be able to say those words on the radio?
This show is on terrestrial radio.
I think it'd be awful.
If it was on satellite
awful.
Radio, I'm not saying every other word. You think there are times?
I think it'd really be bad.
Well, can I do one more and then we'll get to the calls? How about when the news, when somebody in the news says a curse word, for lack of a better expression, it is part of the story. And the newspaper or the television or radio show won't repeat the word, even though it's part of the news story. You don't think that's ridiculous?
Do you have an example?
There are a million examples. It happens all the time.
Well, think
when someone's great, when someone curses at someone, a public figure or something like that, and they don't use the word, but even though it is part, not only part
I don't
of
want the anchors repeating the word on the anchor desk.
877-301-8970. It's your turn. We don't have a lot of time, but we'll get as many calls as we can. Kevin and Randolph, you're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hello, guys. I can swear with the best of them, but swearing really, conversational swearing is really just laziness, because I could talk to you two right now for half an hour, and neither one of us would swear. We wouldn't
Correct.
Have the slightest bit of difficulty saying what we have to say, making our points. We won't have to watch ourselves and guard ourselves. We simply won't do it. If I go to my mother's for Sunday dinner and my brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, I'll talk for 3 hours and I won't swear
sure.
once. When I go to work Monday, the swears will start to flow. So we have a choice of doing it, and I think you called it an exclamation point, Jim, and it is, but it's pretty much a lazy exclamation point, because most of our lives we don't do it. You know, I haven't heard you drop an F-bomb on the air in however many years you've been on this show.
Well, actually,
and I don't think it's difficult for you to refrain from doing that.
Well, your notion that it is a choice is completely proven by what you just said. That when we all go to our mother's houses or some sort of proper function or on the radio, we don't do it. So obviously we don't have to. Again, I wouldn't be upset if there were less of it, Kevin. I'm just saying when people get all bent out of shape
because it's
just enough. You know, that's I guess that's where I am on this. Not that I would suggest that every other word should be one of those. Kevin, thanks for the call, though. It was a good one. We appreciate it. Let's go to Watertown where Aaron's on the phone. Aaron, thanks for calling. Hi.
Thanks, guys. How you doing?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Good. I was just going to say a way that swearing can be useful. I am a mental health counselor, and I've worked a lot in addiction. And when I use colorful language, I think it brings me to my client's level, and they can feel more comfortable with me. They can speak freely. I'm not going to give them SHIT for what they're doing. I mean, they can do whatever they want with me. I'll say it back. And we're just two humans talking rather than them coming to me and being this, you know, maybe hoity-toity, you know, maybe more just a professional they don't feel comfortable with. So
I hear that, but Aaron, the implication in your call is that, and I'll put words in your mouth, you correct me if I'm wrong, that the more working class you are, the more likely to swear. Is that where you're going?
No, I've just said it's been useful in my dealings with clients and that I happen to work in a lot in addiction.
Uh-huh.
People use more expletive language when they're going through tough times.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, okay.
I feel that, you know, it almost creates a bond with my client that they know that they can talk freely, that I'll say what I'm thinking, that we can be more comfortable within a session.
That makes total sense to me. Erin, thank you for the call. I'll tell you one
Chris
difference.
Chris said he used to swear like a sailor. He gave it up for Lent. He hasn't sworn since. Wow. I feel a lot better about myself, he says. It lowered my blood pressure, I think. You should try it, Jim.
You know, getting back to Kevin from Randolph's point, which I tried to make, but he made it much better than I did. It is true. We've been on the radio 16 years. Have you ever said a curse word unintentionally?
Yes.
You did?
Yes, I was doing a promo and I got it wrong like four times in a row. I remember I swore.
Oh, you did? I don't remember
that,
actually.
Yeah, I did. It was bad.
Okay, I can't remember a time.
It was almost history, Jim.
I don't think so. But the point that we can control it and choose not. But see, I feel weird about that.
I never swore on my children when they were little. Never. And I would go to work and swear all day long. So you definitely can control it. And as Kevin said,
you don't think this radio show would be more I'm not suggesting an endless succession of, let's call it for purposes of this discussion, inappropriate language. You don't think why are you smiling at me?
Because you do swear a lot.
I do.
And you sit at your desk, like I said, saying these, you know, for like silly things. Where's my expletive coffee? What did I do in my shirt? It becomes such an adjective for you. We would be swearing from beginning to end on the show.
I'm not calling for that.
Like listening to The Sopranos. I mean, I get it. They're mobsters.
Sopranos,
whatever they are. They're mobsters. But even with them,
no, don't
if
tell
it's
me,
over
think...
and over and over and over, it's like too much. You know, it has to be. It's just
so
too
when
much.
We're in the newsroom, and I'm, as you just think, I appreciate you describing my normal behavior. Do you think that's phony or that's how I talk?
I think that is how you talk.
Okay, and so...
So if you were on the radio and you could... There weren't the seven deadly words. What are they called on the radio? The seven words you can't say, whatever they are, that you would be saying them, from 11 to 2.
I doubt that. Mike, you're in Carver. You are next on Boston Public Radio.
That was a expletive deleted call.
Hi, Mike.
Touched one reason lazy. I'm a teacher. It doesn't bother me, but, you know, I got to curb it in my classroom. And I'll tell the kids the three reasons. One's lazy, you mentioned it. The other one is ignorance. And the other reason people swear is to sound cool. Now, which one is Jim? Well, that's what I want to know.
By the way, the third one is a good addition to the conversation. A lot of people do it to sound cool. You were, Mike, sadly, you're right.
A lot of people, present company included, I would say.
What you're probably right. What level of school do you teach?
High school.
I've told Marjorie this story before. I don't know if I've ever told on the air. I used to be the only father who went to the swim classes at the Y in Cambridge. And so there were a ton of mothers, and I was – because my schedule was such, I could go. I was the only father there. And so my job would be when they were first graders, when the first graders would go in the locker room, the boys, to get ready, I had to take care of the boys, and one of the mothers took care of the girls. I have never used language, much less heard language – that like that which emanated from the across the lips of these first grade boys is just unbelievable. So, Mike, how hard is it to? I mean, a kid would never say it in a classroom, correct?
I think you're a little far removed from a classroom, Jim.
It's bad,
but it's not bad. No, I mean, what's tough is sometimes you try to ignore it to try, like, because you heard it whispered or something like that. But most of the time, you know, I just call a kid out and I just say, just like the previous caller said, it's like, look, you need to learn how to turn a filter on and off. You do it. You would never say that in front of your grandmother.
Great point.
This is another place where you know you don't use that language.
Yeah.
And if you get kids who argue, but you know, like my three reasons: ignorance, laziness, and you're trying to sound cool. There is no other reason why someone would swear.
Mike thinks I hit the trifecta. Mike, thank you for your call. It was a good one.
Okay. Andrew just emails and says, swearing in public is completely inappropriate, another sign of the decline of Western civilization. One can make his or her point emphatically without swearing. One degrades oneself and the entire atmosphere within earshot.
Despite what I've said for the last 20 minutes or 15 minutes, when I do hear people loudly, not in anger, that's always bad. I hear people in normal conversation with a loud voice in public use foul language, I'm offended too. So
well,
I guess
listen,
I'm
Jimmy
makes
a great point too. I do think public swearing is out of control. I'd like to be able to take my son on the bus or to a baseball game of the call for bonus education and expletives. We used to make this joke and we got in trouble because they were tired of us making fun of them. But you know the escalators at the Cambridge Side Galleria.
Sure.
You go up one side, you go down the other side. Everybody's together.
That's unbelievable.
The swearing.
The worst I've ever. I would agree. The worst I've ever heard.
And I remember going over there when my children were little, and it was like, you know, 35 F-bombs before you get to the top of the
escalator.
I've
told you that I rarely intercede in situations like this. I actually did ask a couple of teenagers years ago when my kids were little. This is a totally true story about which I'd forgotten about until you said it. And I said, could you please keep the language down? My kids are little.
Yeah.
And you know what the kid told me?
I can imagine.
Exactly. He told me to blank myself. I mean, I had totally, I'm changing my opinion in the 15 minutes we have. Unfortunately, no more time.
Okay. Oh, we don't have any more time.
No, that's
the show. Oh, my goodness. The show is over.
Marjorie, before we leave, just briefly, if we can, as you know, I brought in my times from the two New York City marathons. Around my photograph is on BOS Public Radio finishing the New York City Marathon. Do you have either pictures or any information?
I'll have to look for the pictures. A photographer took a lot of pictures of
me
in Vermont.
Well,
I don't know. They're not online because it was before.
So let me just be clear because we've got to go. You don't have any pictures, nor do you have any record of having finished. Is that correct? Okay, I'm done. It's fine. Good. Tease the more show.
I'll look for the records when I go home, Jim. Might take me a few days. Okay, thank you guys for tuning in. Tomorrow, we have Asked the Attorney General, but the new Attorney General, Maura Healey, will be here in studio to take your questions and ours. Nancy Cannon also joins for Open Mic. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen. Our engineer is John Parker. I really did run those marathons, even though Jim is disparaging me. I am Marjorie Egan, ex-member. marathon runner.
3:39:56 in New York City.
Okay, 3:21. Marine Corps
marathon.
Well, except
I wrote in my document. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.
Bye.
Happy Marathon Day. Happy Patriots Day.